Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner wird präsentiert von Bet at Home, dem offiziellen Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League. Hol dir jetzt deinen Eishockey-Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Unsere Liga, dein Spiel.
Achtung! Was für ein Move! Nächste Chance! Was für ein Pass zur Mitte! 1-0! Und der nächste Fight am Eis entbrennt! Hier entladen sich die Emotionen! Da haben wir doch noch was, um mit der Zunge zu schnalzen.
Folge 14 von Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner ist Coaches Only. Greg Ireland vom HCB Südtirol spricht über die aktuelle Covid-19-Situation bei seinem Team und seine bald 30-jährige Coaching-Karriere. Rob Daum analysiert im Anschluss das Powerplay des KAC in seiner Taktikanalyse und Trainerlegende und Puls 24 Eishockey-Experte Greg Holtz blickt auf die wichtigsten Wendepunkte seiner Karriere zurück. Das und noch viel mehr jetzt bei It is coaches only on Hockey O'Clock, and for that matter, it was long overdue to finally get him on the podcast. He is the head coach of HCB Südtirol Alperia. He is Greg Ireland, and now on Hockey O'Clock. Coach, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk hockey, especially during these tough times and long months, to be able to get on and discuss the game and hopefully kind of put more of a direction and more of a focus on hockey once again.
Even though, first of all, we have to talk a little bit about those tough times. I mean, obviously you and we, the league would love to have more games this weekend. Obviously only three are going to happen. COVID-19 has hit some teams pretty hard. How's the current situation in Bolzano for your team?
Well, without getting into specifics, numbers or people, we've had kind of a bout a few weeks ago, which was a surprise for us initially, because I thought we had done a good job. We'd really, the players had taken ownership of it. We were doing a great job, and there's no way to say where it happened. I have my feeling on that, and where we had our contact point. And then we fought back and got it going. We played last weekend. You could see that the guys had been off. It was 3 weeks for some, 23 days for some. And you could see how much it takes. Guys don't like to miss 3 days of skating. And then right after the, right on the road trip, not after, we had a few more cases as well. So, it's as we said, it doesn't know any borders. It doesn't know where to stop at the dressing room door. And it certainly doesn't, a slowdown for anybody. So we can see now that there's all the teams in the league are experiencing it. And the ones that aren't having a heavy dose, I'm sure at some point that they will. But we're hoping for the future that we find some answers, or it kind of gets itself under control.
As tough as it may now be, and we're recording this conversation on Saturday, October the 24th, it's going to see the light of day on Tuesday. Do you think your team is or might be ready to go this upcoming weekend? What's the outlook the doctors gave you?
It's hard to say. We don't know yet. As we just had some positive tests the other day, we talked last night. We're probably going to have to test again. I think we're going to try for this afternoon or tomorrow. I think we have to retest the guys that are negative again. And that's the one thing that I think that's come out of this. I think that, the ability to be able to test more often, because we know that, you can test today, but it only means at that moment that you're negative. It's still an incubation period. You could contact something this afternoon and within 24 hours be positive. So the more that I think you can control your environment in terms of knowing, if you can pull a positive guy out quicker, you maybe eliminate those five or six guys. And that's the message I think that as a league that we're trying to get across to all the teams is that, there's no sense saying, well, let's not test today. We have a game. We'll test tomorrow. It's better, I think, if you test now, and if, let's say there's two guys, you pull them out, as opposed to going in the dressing room on the bench playing together. And now what's happened is you come out tomorrow with eight guys because of the contact and possibly transmitting we don't know that it can, but possibly transmitting it to the other team or to the referees. So I think just having knowledge, being cautious, being smart, and you know, we really kind of, you know, we had a couple guys the other day that after practice, they were like, geez, I feel something in my chest. So they went right to the doctor and we found out they had a little bit of a flu. But it's good to know. It's good to address it. You know, we've always been taught that, don't worry about it, fight your way through it. I think that mentality has changed now.
Now, obviously, all the teams are following the league protocols. The Bet at Home Ice Hockey League has done a good job of dealing with the mini crisis, quote unquote. Just to give listeners a little bit of perspective, how often do teams or Bolzano specifically get tested? How did it work from training camp onwards?
We started training camp with not very many guys. We had just finished the national team camp. And we started, I think we had 8 players, 7 and a goalie to start the first week. But it, you know, we were tested every week from that point, and a minimum of once a week, sometimes 2 and then sometimes 3, depending on new arrivals. So, you know, and so we were tested a lot, and those regulations came down from the Italian government, not from the league. We had a little bit higher standard. And for the first 5 weeks, I thought it was excellent. We had no positive cases. We played an exhibition game and I think the contact was made there. I said, hey, I think there was a little bit of a lapse in protocol, from the other team. And sure enough, after saying that, 3 days later, we had our first case. And then 2 days after that, we had a couple more. So, we had done a really good job. I like it, but I look back now and think, geez, we could have been better here. We're constantly learning, as we go, you know, better ways to kind of keep things under somewhat of a control.
Now, you were talking about the early stages of training camp. It's kind of become a habit that Bolzano, first of all, starts training camp a little later than other teams, and probably not with a full roster. But it also started with you being one of the, I think, last 2 head coaches to be officially named in the offseason. What made you decide on coming back, especially to a region that's been really ravaged by the virus?
Well, I would say this in terms of that last part is that I think if you're going to say, well, first of all, our region last March wasn't ravaged. We you know, being here, a lot of it was, you know, a lot of it was, the numbers were in Bergamo, Milano area. And before we left, you know, the lockdowns were starting, the restaurants were closing, you couldn't go out. But there wasn't as many cases that I know of anyway. I don't want to go on record stating official numbers, but there wasn't that many. And then even coming back, I will say that I was really, really you know, pleased and proud to see the people observing the rules here. They were really, really behind what the government was preaching. But in terms of coming back into Europe alone, where the numbers have been high, I would say that, you know, our area in Canada, I'm a little bit more north of Toronto and a little bit more rural, very small town or village. You know, we haven't had a lot of cases. We probably go 12 weeks in a row with 0 cases. You know, lately it's been, we have 1, then 2 weeks of 0. Then I saw the other day we had 3. But I just felt that it's around the world, and at the same time, I'm not going to stop living my life. I'm healthy. I stay in shape. I eat well. I'm active. I think there's still a lot more damage to being inside. But I will say this, that's for me. I observe the rules when I go out. I wear a face mask. I distance because I'm really paranoid now of it from a perspective of A, giving it to someone else who maybe doesn't handle it well as me. With their body, or bringing it back in with my club, and also, you know, giving it to someone else and maybe shutting down our team or the league. So that's been our focus here with our team, is from health and safety first, respect the rules, you know, but at the same time, we've got to go about our business a little bit in terms of preparation and planning and getting ready. So that's the way I looked at it. And coming back to Bolzano, for me, I came back because I really like the team. I really like the people involved with the team, the players, the staff. Management treated me well while I was here. I know the reputation, but let's be honest. I've coached in three places in Europe, and you know, as Franz Kahle says to me, you've coached in three of the most volatile spots for coaches in Europe. I've been fired out of one of them. I'll probably be fired again. I don't worry about that. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to coach hockey. I'm here to create relationships and meet new people. And I will say on the other side, but I've also coached in three of the most beautiful areas in Europe as well. So the experience to me and the adventure is a lot better. In each of them, I've enjoyed a lot of things and I've enjoyed the coaching. So that's what I'm here to do. Like you said, I'm a lifer in hockey, and part of that life is creating new relationships and experiences. And I'm in a great spot here, a great hockey spot, a great fan base, beautiful area. Why wouldn't I want to come back?
I'm going to talk about those European destinations in just a bit. When getting to Bolzano, when trying to put together your team, you were telling us about the eight players and one goaltender at the start of the camp. According to which principles did you try to put your team together for the 2020-2021 season?
Well, the thing I think for us is, one, our goaltending was settled. We knew early who our two goalies would be once that, they had committed to coming back. You know, having Irving and Fazio was a no-brainer. Not only are they good goalies, they're great people. And that's part of what I've always believed in is that, people first, talent second. And if your scouts are doing it right, or the people that you talk to, or the names that you're coming across, you should be looking at the upper echelon of talent. Now, the number one filter for me then is, what kind of people are they? Do they bring a positive attitude? Do they work hard? Do they treat their teammates well? Are they good in the community? Are they guys that seek out solutions as opposed to always pointing out problems? So we wanted good people in our locker room. From the back end, I think the one thing we wanted was mobility, the ability to make plays with the puck, be able to make reads with hockey sense, and then up front we have a lot of returning guys, and I'm pretty proud. We were talking about this the other day. We have, for the first time in a long time, we have a lot of guys returning, and why that was so special was because we have a good group of people. That's what brought me here. My first indication of coming to Bolzano, I wasn't sure. I was a little bit trepid about the waters, and from the history that you hear. And what I've learned is, don't always listen to what's out there, do your own homework. And then I looked at the roster and I talked to some people, and they said, I think you'll enjoy it there. And I went, and I really, really liked the players. And so to see a lot of them back and a majority of them back is good for us. Now, the challenge of that is we had some success. You get comfortable. Number two, everybody wants a little bit more piece of the pie when you've had success. But although we didn't win a thing last year, we won some games. So now we have to, we knew coming in, we'd have to temper that and get our thoughts back on track. And then we were doing a really good job. I thought we were prepared for the season, despite a really different training camp. Like I said, we started with a small number of players. The next week we added five more. Then we got three more. So the practices were a lot different than I'd done in the past. But I think that was a good thing, because there's a standard way we've done the training camp in the past to start the year. This year was it was a different focus. And I think that when we hit the season, we were in really good shape physically. Maybe not tactically where I would like the team, but pretty solid. And I think we were together as a group. Now, the last several weeks have thrown us a curveball. But it's early in the year, and we'll regroup, and we'll get those areas back on track.
Keep talking about the sporty side. In training camp, each and every week you get additional talent. How do you try to work them in? How do you do it from a playbook standpoint to slowly but steadily get them up on pace?
Well, I think the good thing is a lot of guys returning from last year, they knew what we wanted. But again, I've learned also that players hit push a reset button. They close their minds down in the summer because they need to. We all need to. You need to get away from the game and put your focus on your family, and even your hobbies, whether it's golfing, fishing, or get a reading book, because if not, you become stale in this game pretty quick. So what I've learned is don't expect the guys to come back every year and be right where they were mentally. So we have to push a reset. What we have always believed in the teaching method of whole part, whole teaching. You take the whole piece of what you're doing, the whole defensive scheme, but take the whole part, and then take a piece of it and teach a piece, another piece and another piece, and then bring it all back together. But I've never done it as much as I've done this year. Because of the numbers, we couldn't do full pieces of our tactics. So we took very small pieces. It might be two guys working us, but we did it over and over. And then we took another small. So I've never done as much as I've done this year. And so we were able to just work on specifics. And within that, you also get a lot more skill development. You get a lot more, a lot more. And then later when you bring it back, then you explain it to the player. Hey, that little thing that we did there is all part of this breakout. And then it clicks. The other thing that we did for new players is we have everything that we do because Fab and I do a lot of coaches seminars in the summer. I speak quite a bit. I'm an instructor for Hockey Canada and USA Hockey. So we do a lot of presentations. So everything we have is on PowerPoint. We've put our whole system on PowerPoint. For instance, we'll have our forecheck. We'll have a diagram explanation and also a purpose. This is what we want to achieve in our forecheck. This is what we want to do. This is what each player's role. We'll have a diagram and then we'll have a video clip. So when a guy comes in who's new, we're able to sit him down, show him that. And we're able to, we also have done Zoom calls with that too. So, this new technology of being able to, I did it with the national team. I walked through our systems this summer with the national team on Zoom chats. And it's really beneficial because, but at the same time, you have to respect the fact that there's different learners. There's visual, there's auditory, there's kinesthetic who need the hands-on and the walkthrough. So, that guy looking at that PowerPoint, he might not be seeing it the way that it needs to be seen. So you have to respect that and be able to circle back with him and be able to walk him through on the ice. So there's a little bit more hands-on. It doesn't roll as quickly as you want. So it took a lot of patience.
A lot of people in Austria and a lot of fans of the Better Home Ice Hockey League always marvel at the imports Bolzano is getting. There's a whole pipeline of talent that came in via Bolzano and is now playing elsewhere. Now, that you've been involved in that process during the summer, how does Bolzano do it? You mentioned the character first attitude that you're kind of looking for. Is that the secret ingredient to getting all those imports over, or is there another secret to your success?
Well, two things. I'll touch on that, and then I want to just talk about another thing after. But first of all, I think a lot of the guys that are in the league are have nothing to do with me. Like that's Dieter and the Bolzano people. I think one thing with Dieter is that he doesn't get enough credit for is that, yes, he's very hands-on but he's constantly day and night on the phone with agents and some scouts that he has and different people. He gets a lot of names. And it's funny you say that because we were talking about the other day that, you look through the league and you see guys that, on other teams, they all seem to touch ground here. And it's like Plymouth Rock in North America, when the Pilgrims first set down, this is kind of the landing point. I don't know if this is the first direct flight somewhere close to here or what, but anyway, there is a lot. But what I've learned and I've tried to really, since I've been over here, I find that there's a lot of managers that, they go based strictly on what the scouts tell them, or not the scouts, the agents. Hey, you better sign this guy because, this team are about to sign him and he's a good player. And having been part of NHL organizations, I've sat in those scouting meetings. I've sat in the training camps when the scouts are all fighting. And I can tell you that in every single one of them, I can tell who was responsible for drafting which player. The ones that are battling hard to get a guy on the team, that's who they drafted. And so what I really learned from there is that you've got to do your own homework. You can't listen to the guy that represents that player all the time. It's in his best interest if that player gets signed. You've got to go out. And I think what I was able to bring to the equation this year is that I've been around the game long enough that I know enough scouts or players. So usually what I do is that if I get a name, I'll call at least five people. I try to get, three coaches, maybe a player on that team that I know and I can trust. And I even try to get the equipment manager or trainer because they see a lot more than we see. And I make sure that those things that I'm told never get repeated. They stay with me, but then it allows me to either put a thumbs up or a thumbs down on that player because you, you, you can look at numbers and you can look at statistics, and a lot of players can put up statistics, but the key is, can you win with them? You know, when the going gets tough and you've been playing all year, and this is going to be a tough year. This year is going to be, we told our group, this is going to be the team that can take the most crap, you know, off the ice, you know, the setbacks, the adversities, the speed bumps, the, you know, the real kick in the groins, so to speak. And so you're looking for players that, you know, have gone through those things in their career and still come up smiling and come up working and digging in and, you know, have had success. There's something to be said for a guy that's won championships, but been a part of that, not just a peripheral player. So for me, that's really important. And we've had some heavy debates here on players that I've, you know, done some really heavy homework and just saying, hey, you know, and, you know, you want to make sure it's the right fit in your locker room all the time.
Not too long ago in this country, people scouted, or quote unquote scouted, players off of elite prospects, which always led to return flights at the end of October or the beginning of November. But you were talking about those people that you trust and that you call the equipment managers and the coaches. How big is that circle of trust? How many people are we talking about that you really trust in this business, that you kind of have developed a close relationship over the years?
Well, it's funny because one player that we talked about and we debated hard, I called three coaches, and one guy I had worked with and I've known him for 25 years, another guy that I've coached against and become very good friends with him, I've known him for 20 years, and the third guy, I coached him, he played for me. So these were guys that I had heavy trust in. And when they spoke about this player, and funny enough, we didn't end up signing him, but and it wasn't because of them. They loved them. So I put my stamp of approval on it, but you know, that's just how it goes. But I would tell you that you build relationships, and what I've always learned, you know, and maybe that helps being in the East Coast League where you don't have a scouting staff, you develop your contact pool. And I've always believed that you should see a player before signing them, but it's hard now in this business, you know, in Europe, and especially, you know, in the East Coast League, you can't always do that. So what I've always done is made notations. I keep a long file, and I always remember or have it down what a person told me. And at the end of the year, I go back and review it. And then, you know, you can say, hey, that guy was right on what he told me. That was right on. I got that's trust. You know, this guy was so far off the map. I don't think I'm going to make that call again down the road. So, you know, it's about trust. It doesn't mean you lose a friendship over it. You just don't ask again. And you know, it's like a successful business. If you have a supplier that, you know, gives you a good product at a good price and you build trust with it, you're going to consistently go back to them. If you have one that consistently gives you a product that gives you bad, bad customer feedback, a lot of returns, it's a bad investment for your money, you're going to stop using it.
Now, this process of putting a team together, of looking for new players, there are thousands of players out there with the decision of the British Ice Hockey League not playing the season, with Germany still waiting to start theirs, with probably East Coast Hockey League and AHL and the NHL, whenever they start playing. So many more players are on the market. How does does an average summer look like as regards you spending time with scouting reports, talking to coaches, spending time on the phone to this summer?
Well, this summer was different for me because, you know, having been in Europe before, like in Lugano, you know, Roland would send me a list of names and he'd say, go do your homework. And then away I would go. And it wasn't that bad. I could do it from my backyard and, you know, the cell phone and the computer go anywhere. So it works really well. And it was good. And we weren't looking for too many because it was only four imports in Switzerland. And usually you're returning a few anyway. You know, although I felt in Lugano, we should have been looking for a few more. I will say that, you know, this summer I got here July the 2nd. I was in quarantine for a couple of weeks before the first camp with the national team. And then, you know, from that point on, I was kind of living in a hotel. So I had a lot of time on my hands. And, you know, even before signing, you know, it looked like we were moving in that direction. Dieter would send me some names and I would start to go to work. And I even phoned the player because you want to get a perspective on the player's you know, what he's looking for, what his attitude, you know, it's hard to tell on them. You know, a lot of guys are you know, are going to say what you want to hear, but you know, you kind of match it with what you're hearing from other people too. So I think it's really good. And the other thing is there's an honesty. You can at least say, hey, look, this is what our expectations are. This is what we want. You know, this is the role we have. That way it's discussed up front. There's no surprises.
It's easier than ever before to get your hands on game tape. But obviously you said you wanted to see players first, obviously in person, not always possible, but on tape, very much so. Is there ever a time where you say, poof, this just been enough. I can't watch more tape anymore.
Well, that's the thing is that you know, when you get now you can break it down to the shift. You don't have to watch the whole game. So you can see, you know, if he gets eight shifts in a period, you can watch those eight shifts for much quicker than you can in the past. But the thing is you want to watch, for me, at least I always try to get 5 to 7 games in on a guy because, you know, 2 or 3 is not enough. Maybe one game, if you watch one game, you go, oh geez, he was terrible. You know, you don't know what's going on. You know, maybe he played sick that night. Maybe something happened at home. But when you get it's like statistics, the more data and more groupings you have, you know, then, you know, it kind of balances out and you get a much better feel for him. You know, things like body language, it's, you know, things like response after a bad shift or a goal against, or, you know, or is, you know, like little things. Does he tap the goalie on the pads after a goal against, you know, try and pick his teammates up? You know, how does he respond after getting a heavy hit? You know, though, you know, you get to see a guy go in the corner for the puck, not 4 or 5 times, but if you watch that number of games, you're going to probably see it, you know, over 20 times. So you're going to see, you know, a statistical number where, hey, he goes in the corner, he usually comes out with the puck, you know, or he goes to the hard areas consistently. So to me, that's important is, you know, it's the same with visual scouting in North America. The good scouts don't go just 2 or 3 times to see a player. You know, they're making an investment. They want to go a number of times and make sure that they're bang on.
Now, if you do have a choice of games from a player you're interested in, are there specific games that you're going to look at first? For example, game sevens or blowout losses to see how he handles himself afterwards? Or is any game interesting for you?
Well, for me, obviously, I want to see them play against good teams and teams that are hard to play against, not a freewheeling open style. I want to see a team that's heavy on the forecheck and tough on the boards, got good grit and hard to beat on the defensive side. But the odd time, if, you know, you see a team losing 8-1, it's not bad to watch that, especially the third period and see how that, you know, are the second and third efforts still there? Are you still blocking shots? Is he still giving? You know, or as you know, as he stopped, is his try level stopped? You know, so it's really important, I think, that you see a little bit of a range, but the more you can see against hard to play against teams, tough teams, you know, that's a character revealer.
I want to talk about the coaching business in a little more general terms. We've had it before. You're kind of a coaching lifer, although you're still in your mid-50s and who knows what's still to come. But how did you get into coaching?
Well, for me, I think early on I knew that my playing career wasn't going to extend to the National Hockey League. And you know, in my small town where I lived, a bunch of us were playing junior hockey. And while we were young, a friend of mine's dad just sort of said to me, all of us, hey, you guys, we need help coaching the younger groups. You're going to come out and help. And then after a few weeks of doing it, they said, in order to be on the ice, you have to get your level 1 and 2 from Hockey Canada. So we did those over 2 weekends. And it was, this is kind of neat. And we enjoyed doing it. It was a lot of fun. And then went away to school and, you know, after playing in that and, you know, started working and right away, you can play in those, you know, those senior leagues, which would be like playing in the second or third division here, that level of hockey. But what happens is you got to get up for work in the morning too, you know, so then you're looking for other ways to stay invested in the game. And for me, I turned to coaching because, you know, my background at university was in physical education. Through the university, I was able to, get involved with coaching as well, while still playing. So, you know, it was kind of coming at me just quietly from different directions. And basically I was, knew that kind of maybe, you know, once I was done playing that, you know, I want to stay in the game and find a way to do it. And I did it as a hobby. I never really suspected that this could become a career. at any point. I just did it because I really enjoyed it and I was competitive, and I found that I really liked the teaching aspect of it. I like kind of learning more about the game and passing that on and breaking the game down, even in terms of, because my background at school, as I said to you, was in biomechanics and kinesiology. Being able to teach a skating stride or shooting or things like that, breaking those things down kind of came natural to me, and I enjoyed that.
The hobby part that you mentioned, Coach, is a very interesting one, because what I'm always interested in is at what point did you know, hey, I'm better at this than some other people? This might be not only a hobby, this might be a career.
The one thing is, even to this day, I never get the feeling that I'm better at this than anybody. I think the perspective I've always taken, it's kind of like how I was as a player, was that I can work harder at this than anybody else. I enjoy it more than most people. I have passion for it, and there's some doors starting to open. So I think I want to do this. That's kind of more how, and to this day, I look at it like every time we're coming up against a team, I always have respect for the guy on the other bench. We've all gotten to this level through our own different directions, and there's a lot of really good coaches out there, and there's a lot of really good coaches not working. So, who am I to say that, oh, geez, I what my system is or the way I do things is better. I'm learning all the time and adjusting. But what I found was that, if you have passion and you work hard and you're willing to grind and go with the ups and downs and, getting fired, then and rebounding, then you can do this job. But what happened for me is, after getting that start, I was coaching junior hockey, which is very big in Canada. And, but it did, at the time it didn't pay like it does now. And you had to have a full-time job. So I had another job that, my boss knew that I coached hockey, but I learned structure and organization that way. I had to go in early and do my job and make sure my numbers were up. And then I would leave and I was coaching GM, and we were having success as a team. And then all of a sudden I started to get some offers. The first couple of years I didn't really think I could do it. The money wasn't great. I turned it down, and actually I coached another sport as well. And I had an offer to go to NCAA to coach as an assistant coach at Cornell University as a lacrosse coach. And the money wasn't very good, so I decided that I wouldn't go, and hockey was my passion. But then after a couple of years of getting a couple offers, I decided that maybe I would give this a try. I went to my boss and I said, look, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to leave now. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a year sabbatical from work. Go give it a shot and see. And I went to the East Coast. I had an offer in the OHL at the time and the East Coast League. I went to the East Coast League. And after a year, I came back and he said, how did you like it? And I said, it was good. He said, I'll give you one more year then. So I had another year sabbatical. And after the second year, I knew that I wanted to kind of continue in that direction. I still didn't think I had the ability or opportunity maybe to move to the AHL, just because a lot of guys were, guys at that level were former NHLers and, guys had coached a long time. And so, but I was enjoying what I did. And then I didn't really apply for any AHL jobs until about my fourth year, and then decided that maybe now's time to take that step.
Two questions that I want to ask you because of what you just said. That the one thing that interests me, why the East Coast Hockey League versus the Ontario Hockey League? Why coaching adults versus juniors? How did that decision come about?
Well, it's funny you say that, because the OHL is a very well-respected league and very high profile, more so now than at that time, but still very good. And a lot of, guys that have coached there have really moved on, and the East Coast League wasn't really known as, but what happened for me was that the job in the OHL was as an assistant GM, where the job in the East Coast League was a chance to be a head coach and GM. And that was number one. Number two was money. But number three was a chance to try a pro. And I found out after 4 months not ready I was to coach pro. I was coaching them like they were juniors the first few months, and it wasn't good. Then I kind of had a little bit of a come to Jesus with myself, and I think after Christmas, I got better as a pro coach and I took charge and I started to coach that team. And I look back now that I thought I did a good job back then, but I look back and how poorly I did now. But I think at the same time, there was a number of reasons, and I'm not always saying it's the best choice. You know, I look back and I'm like, geez, why'd I turn the OHL down? That was, but it's the choice that got me here. And maybe the other choice might have led me a different way, even though, it's a high profile league, maybe something, who knows, so you get to where you're supposed to be. Sometimes those decisions you make for a reason kind of, always they lead you there.
When talking about coaching adults versus juniors and you and your coming to Jesus moment, what specifically changed, if you had to put your finger on that one aspect that helped you after Christmas?
Well, I think there was a little bit of, not intimidation, but you're dealing with pros and you're second guessing yourself. Wow, they've been doing this all. We had some guys on a team that played in the NHL and they've been around, and I'm coming out of tier two junior A, and so I believed in my system, I believed in all that. But you start looking and go, well, they know a little bit more than I do in terms of the pro game, whether it's scheduling or whatever. So okay, we'll go. And then I realized that, hang on a second here, it's just, hockey is hockey. We're all teaching the same thing. It's just a different set of problems at a different level. And someone's got to take charge and lead. And, the players, some players are asking for certain things for, their own reasoning. It's not always what's best for the team. And, as a coach, your job is tasked with making the decision that's best for the team. So that's when I kind of realized that, hey, I have to, be the guy that drives the ship. It's okay to invite some conversation, but at the end of the day, it has to be my decision and I have to stand by it. And I think when I got to that point and I realized that there were some players that, maybe were long in their career and their values weren't the same as my values and the team's values, it was maybe time to search out some new players. That really helped as well.
Now, you coach your way up from junior hockey to the East Coast Hockey League, to the American Hockey League, all the way to Europe. How does one work his way up the ranks? How does one get recognized? Is it wins-based only? Is it the relationships? Is it a combination of those two and some more elements? How does it work?
When I went into the East Coast Hockey League, the guy that was leaving is a really good friend of mine. He was going to the American League, Mark Kumpel. Mark was leaving that job and was responsible for hiring me. And actually Mark came to Bolzano last year for a visit. So we're still pretty good friends. He said to me, you will get more opportunity to move up from here on in, through, I always thought it was winning. If I win, get championships, I'm going to get a chance. But by development, promoting your players, if you see a team in the American League at that time, they had the international IHL as well, loses a center, pick up the phone and call. Let your players, help your players get to the next level. Be a developer. And so for the next 5 years, four of the years, we led the league in call-ups. And I think the fifth year, we were number two or number three. We would have guys with, six, seven different teams at certain times. So we were able to get players moved to the next level, but at the same time, we had a really consistent record for success in terms of winning and losing at the same time, because players wanted to come play for us because the fact that we were promoting, it was a good place to get to the higher levels, and it helps to recruit. You want to win games, you get good players. That's it. Coaches don't take a shift. They don't score goals. Every system has its value. Good players help you win. So, in order to recruit good players, they got to know that you have an interest in them and helping their career.
Now, as development is probably a lot of coaches' goals, how does it work? What are the core principles that you have applied throughout your career when trying to develop talent?
Well, I'll go back to that last question. The other thing you mentioned is, does relationships help? 100%. That'll get you a job over anything else. And you see that time and again. Coaches, hire who they know. It's about trust. And so developing relationships. I've got a few jobs though. I will say that the job in Grand Rapids I got, I didn't know the guy coaching. And I still to this day have great things to say about Danton Cole. He hired me, didn't know me. I thought we worked well together. I learned a lot from him and have a lot of respect for him. He's now the coach at Michigan State, but we didn't know each other, and he wanted someone that was going to come in and challenge him and make him better. And at the same time, he made me better. So I hold him in high regard. But, you know, so I think relationships help, and you see it in the NHL all the time. People surround themselves with what they know.
Now, that step from the East Coast Hockey League to the American Hockey League, how big was that in terms of coaching, in terms of what you had to do? Was it pretty similar, or was it a whole different world, planet?
It was way different. First of all, I went in as an assistant coach, so it was strictly hockey for me. We're in the East Coast League, like Mark Kumpel had said to me going into Dayton, he goes, a lot of days the coaching is going to be the last thing you do. We had to do salary caps every Monday. I was responsible for housing, the busing. I was responsible for getting work visas. You know, all that stuff was a priority just to put your team on the ice. If you don't have a team on the ice, you can't play. You know, because we were getting call-ups, I had to constantly be bringing in other players to fill those holes. You know, and so a lot of that stuff, you know, at the first 2 years, I didn't even have an assistant coach. I did it myself. So, you know, a lot of times it was okay. You know, and I think I did an okay job, not a great job. I think I got better, but I learned how to be much more organized than I thought I was. I thought I was always an organized person. Going to the American Hockey League, hockey-wise, was really good for me. I first went up my last year in the East Coast League. A good friend of mine took over the Hamilton Bulldogs. Claude Julien was the head coach. Jeff Ward was the assistant. Claude got the job. Jeff called me in January and said, hey, I want you to come as the assistant. And I said, I can't. We had the year before we went to the championship. And while we were in the finals of the East Coast League, our owner went bankrupt, lost. You know, the team took midway through the summer, took back the team. And in the meantime, I turned down another OHL job to stay there. And, you know, all this happened. So now comes August, we don't have a team. And a new owner came in 2 weeks before the season. And we tried to put a team together, and you know, we struggled a little bit that year, or a lot compared to what we had done. And so Jeff had called and said, hey, why don't you come with me to the AHL as an assistant? And I said, I'd love to. It's kind of my dream, but I can't do it because there's some players that stayed here waiting for me, and it would be a pretty disloyal move to do that. So he said, well, at the end of the year, when the season's over, come on up. So I got there with two games to go in the season, and went on a playoff run with them, and we went to the finals, lost in game seven. It's a familiar note. from there, one of the teams that was in the semis that year was Grand Rapids. I knew their GM a little bit because we'd sent some players there, and he introduced me to the coach. And from that point on, that's the reason I got the job in Grand Rapids, because he saw how aggressive I was and, you know, going up, you know, to the American League and being willing to do the work and, you know, he liked what I brought. So it got me the job, but I went in strictly on the hockey note. And when you're in the American Hockey League, even as the head coach, player-wise, you might get asked the odd time on a signing, but in the summer, you don't have very much to do other than planning, because the players are brought to you by mostly the NHL team, or the AHL team might sign a couple. And we had a full-time AHL GM. So, you know, basically it was strictly a focus on hockey, which was really good for me. And my time in Grand Rapids, I thought I was a decent coach, but I could tell you that the game changer for me was my second year when Mike Babcock came in. He called myself. Jim Pack was my assistant. Jimmy Pack is coaching Korea now. And I drove down to Detroit to meet Mike and his staff. We got there early, I think for 7 in the morning. And we walk in the room, Paul McClain, Todd McClellan, and Jay Woodcroft. A very, very strong coaching staff. They're all sitting there. And Mike throws the board on the table, coaching board, and says, so tell me, what are you going to do this year systems-wise? And I said, well, I thought we were going to do what you're doing. He said, no, listen, I have a different type of team than you. Coaching is about survival. You've got to do what works for the group of guys. So I went through it, and he said, listen, we're probably about 70, 75% the same. He said, but can I show you some things that we've come up with last year? And they kind of went out, and a lot of the game that you see now, the modern game, you know, with entries and possession and the way the teams break out and defend, it came from that group of guys. And I could tell you, because I've had other coaches in the league who've invited me for dinner and said, you know, I want to know what Detroit does. And a lot of what the teams in the NHL now are based on how Detroit played. So I was very fortunate to be part there. But the best part was that training camp. We always go to Traverse City. They have an 8-team tournament with all the NHL teams, well, not all, 8 NHL teams send their teams. And the American League coaches usually run the team there. The NHL guys, the year before, the other coaching staff, which was really good to meet Barry Smith and Dave Lewis, they were really hands-off. Their approach was different. They were always there to share and talk. But this time was different. Mike said, here's what we're going to do. You're going to run the AHL or the rookie camp, but we're going to sit in on every meeting you have, every video meeting, every team meeting, on the practice in the morning. We're going to have one of us on the ice. In the game, we're going to have one of the, and us meaning NHL coaching staff, and we're going to rotate it every day. And then at the end of the day, we're going to go in the room and we're going to assess the job you did. So we were prepared. Jim and I went up. We had everything done for the week, all our practices. We were organized and we were really pumped up. So the first practice we went in and I thought we had all these nice drills and it was nice. And afterwards, at the end of the day, we went in and we went around the table and they kicked the crap out of us. They, you know, why'd you whistle it so much? You whistled too much. You went to the board too much. You know, why'd you do that drill? It was too complicated. You know, less is more. And they just ripped everything we had apart. I went back to the hotel that night just feeling like I was never going to coach again. We threw everything in the garbage. We did one practice up for the next day, determined to come in and not get picked apart. And that changed the whole way that I coached, the way I approached practice planning, the way I approached teaching my team. It influenced me heavily and made me a way better coach. And I give those guys a lot of credit for that hard lesson.
For all the listeners out there who don't know, Grand Rapids is the AHL affiliate of the Detroit Red Wings. And Mike Babcock doesn't need an introduction. But you sitting at the same table as Mike Babcock, you getting into coaching a decade earlier, now playing with the really big boys. Is there ever a time to be in awe, or did you just go to work?
Detroit was good for me because, you know, on a daily basis, like Mark Howe was our pro scout. So I'd see Mark on the road 10 to 15 times. And of those 10 to 15 times, 8 or 9, he'd have Gordie Howe with him. And Gordie Howe would come in my office and tell stories. And then you go to camp and Ted Lindsay's there in my first training camp, you know, I ran one of the teams for the training camp, and I had Steve Yzerman, Darren McCarty, Lidstrom on my team, Draper. But I'll tell you a fast story that year though. So they had an exhibition game, and usually the guys not playing in the exhibition game practice hard. So they told me, Dave Lewis said, and Barry Smith said, you're running that practice. We have to go for the game. So on that ice that day was, you know, Steve Yzerman, Brett Hall, Hasek, Curtis Joseph, Lidstrom, Yzerman, like you name it, Chelios. And so I ran practice and Jim Nill was the assistant and Jim was pacing the bench. When I came off, I said, Jim, what's the matter? You look concerned. He goes, well, I was a little worried. He said, you know, you're a young coach that's very demanding in practice and you like to push. And Brett Hall, you know, he has a different view of how practice should be. I was a little worried how it would go. He said, but, you know, Holly just came off and said, that was a great practice. And I said, well, I'm pretty smart. I know how to cut the drills that certain players like. But so that kind of opened, it just made me comfortable being around people that had been in the game a long time and, you know, giving the respect that they had and, you know, and at the same time, and, you know, having Scotty Bowman sit there and have conversation with you, you know, and hey, you know, talk, have you ever thought of doing this? Have you ever thought? And then I went from there to work for Wayne Gretzky. And so, you know, the way I look at it is I've been very fortunate to be around some of the greatest players and minds in the hockey world. You know, and I include Ken Holland and Jim Neal in there, Don Maloney. And I've allowed that to influence. I've taken a little bit of something from everybody and it's influenced the way that I look at the game, the way I teach the game, the way I, you know, and I was, you know, fortunate that when Wayne left Phoenix, I took over to run that training camp and coach 5 NHL games. You know, and you know, at the end of the day, if I never get any more, that's fine. you know, with the coach that first game as head coach in Staples Center in LA was pretty special. It was an exhibition game, but it was my exhibition game. But I can tell you the one thing that being around those, you know, the Gordie Howes and the Scotty Bowmans and Gretzky, and I say this to players all the time, I said they were the most humble people. You'd think they had just come off growing up on a farm. The way they talk to you, they treat you as an equal, they handle themselves. I can tell you that they're some of the nicest people you've ever met. And to me, they're people. They're first, not hockey players. And that's what I tell young players now, is that some of them are very cocky and arrogant. And then when you see these greatest names in the game, and they're such good people, it's amazing.
I want to slowly get to the back end of the conversation, because it's already took so much of your valued time. But you've been bouncing around between different coaching jobs, and obviously the job brings it with it that you're being fired, that you have to relocate. How much do you have to love those aspects of the job to keep doing it?
Well, the first part of my career, so I've been fired 3 times. You know, and out of that, you learn. The first one is always a kick in the teeth, and then you learn. And some of the places I've left on my own, Owen Sound, I left on my own accord. Lugano, I left it with a year offer on the table. The first part was hard because you move your family. We decided we would go everywhere together. And then now that my kids are older, we created a home base back in Ontario, Canada. Now I go on my own, and that's the hardest part of being alone. And usually they come over for a couple weeks at a time, you know, 3 or 4 times during the year. So it makes it a lot better. And obviously these video chats are a great way to keep connection. But this year's tough because with the quarantine rules, it's hard for them to come over. So that's the biggest challenge. I think once you get over that first firing, I've never been let go from anything in my life. And when you have the first one, that's hard, and you have a pride that you don't want to ever be let go from anything. But you realize, especially coming to Europe, it's not always the merits of your work that get you there. And if you're a humble person, you look in the mirror and you ask, you know, what part did I play in that? How can I get better? I think you get better from those things. I think, you know, change. If you're an introspective person, you look in the mirror, you can say, okay, how am I going to get to a point where that doesn't happen again? Where did it go wrong, and what can I do better? And you grow from it. You know, it's like a loss in the game. You take the value of the lesson, you apply it, and you move forward.
Now, your career trajectory is a pretty interesting one, going from the East Coast Hockey League to the American Hockey League, going over to Europe, then to the OHL that kind of has always eluded you, back to Europe. How come that you changed the continent, went back, and then went back to Europe again?
Well, this kind of led me to where I am now. So I always look at a coaching job as what's best at that time, not what league it is, what's going to impact me the most, what's going to give me the most joy and the passion, and where can I have the most impact. So as I look at each one when they come up, like at the time, the year before I took the Owen Sound job, right before Lugano, I was offered a job in the Western Hockey League and the OHL. The OHL was for big money, but it was a volatile, really not a great situation. So I said no to both for different reasons. But I look at each situation and I try to analyze and discuss it with my family and see if at the end of the day, they haven't all been the right choice. You look back, oh geez, I probably got myself into something here. But, you know, so I look at coaching as coaching. It doesn't matter what league you're in. But are you having an impact? Are you doing what you should be doing? Are you enjoying it? And for me, that's it. And when I say it gets me to where I'm at is, you know, you hear a lot of times, especially over here, there's been a big push as of late. We need more coaches from, you know, for a while it was Canada, then it was Sweden, then Finland, then this and that. I don't look at myself. I'm a proud Canadian. I'm a proud member of Hockey Canada, which I think is the best organization in the world in terms of educating their players and their coaches, and they're a leader in that department. Not the only one, but there's a lot of great ones, but they do a great job. But I'm no longer just a Canadian coach, a guy that was born and coached in Canada. I'm an international coach. I've been around the world. I've coached against great teams in every league. I've coached in a number of leagues, and I've taken pieces from everybody. You know, I watch how Ferlanda does things. I watch how, you know, Munich, Berlin, Bern, Zurich, Zug, and you take little pieces and you add it to who you are, and you by being in the OHL, the East Coast League, the American League, around the NHL, you know, in Switzerland, Germany, Austria, you start to, they all kind of mold into making this recipe. So now I consider myself an international coach. I think I can take, you know, what I do to any league in the world and bring value.
Now, you've been around some of the most interesting clubs in the German-speaking territories, or Germany, Switzerland, Austria, with Mannheim, obviously a big-time organization, with Lugano, which is always an interesting club in terms of talent turnover and coaching turnover. To lead Lugano to the finals was one thing, but then again, you already mentioned it, Game 7, the finals a couple of years ago, on home ice, you lost to Zurich. Obviously, as hard as it is to lose Game 7, I was lucky enough to observe that game. And at that time, you, right after the game, gave a very now famous interview in Switzerland, where you, first of all, just gotten back from congratulating every member on the opposing team. And then you gave a heartfelt, honest, open interview to the interviewer. How tough was it in that moment to do that interview, and how big a factor to you is sportsmanship in general as a coach?
Well, again, there's always been moments in my career where I haven't been the best at sportsmanship, and I've done things that I've regretted, and you know, either got my wrist slapped for it or kicked my own ass and saying that, you know, that's not good. I'm a competitor first and foremost. And, you know, I come from a school where you, you know, on the ice, you do anything to win, and you compete as hard as you can. And, you know, coaching wise, you give everything you have. And so I've had some regrets, but when I look back on it, I've always been able to look in the mirror and say I was wrong, or go shake someone's hand and say, hey, I apologize that wasn't right. Or, you know, give someone a pat in the back and or handshake and say, hey, you were the better team and you deserved it. Or, hey, it was a great match and we won, but you know, it was a heck of a fight. And I've always believed that after, you have to be accountable to yourself and to your team and your, and the game, and own it. And at the same time, you know, I think in the moments where I've done a good job and I have given everything I have and handled myself in the right way, it's the same thing. You just have to sometimes be accountable to everything, yourself, the game, your family and your team. And that's what I've always tried to be: passionate, competitive, but honest. And to me, you know, that's who I am. It's got me into trouble. It's a strength and it's a weakness. And I'm trying to get better from it all the time. But I also think it's why I've had success and why I've got to the levels I have, because I don't quit. I work hard. I bring a lot. I make mistakes. I fix them. I ask questions. But I think that, you know, being relentless in my pursuit to be better, I strive to get better, and it's allowed me to move up and move to good levels and coach in good teams.
Last question. Before the season, the Bet at Home Ice Hockey League polled fans as to who they think the favorite for the championship is. Now that the championship has eluded you so far, and I don't want to get into that specific, but last year, right when the season was canceled, your team was on a roll. You led the quarterfinals 3-0. You would probably swept the quarterfinals and gone on as one of the heavy favorites as regards winning the title. How did those exit interviews go that each and every coach conducts after the year? What did you tell players?
Well, we just talked about the fact that at the time, to be honest, I didn't think I was coming back. So, you know, it was a lot of very positive. Obviously, we'd won a lot of games and done well, and the guys performed well and worked hard for me and responded to everything. So it was very positive. It was a very, you know, and you know, it just, I, you know, but I was also, I think, because, you know, I was really honest with guys, what they needed to work on, what they needed to do. That's what I take a lot of pride in. And, but there was also a good special relationship because of the respect level for both sides, me for the player, and I think the player for the job that Fab and I did, Fabio Armani, you know, so there was that. So it was pretty, at the same time, I didn't think I was going to be coming back but you know, it's the old story. You never know. Here you are. And I'm glad I am.
I know it's a season that's unlike any other, but that championship, what would it mean for your career if you were finally able to win one?
Well, we won a lot. I won a lot in my junior days, and you know, for me, it's it's always special because, you know, no matter where you are, what league, what team, you put a lot into that year. Your players, you know, you go through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. You know, you love each other, you hate each other, you love each other. You work hard, you go through aches and pains and injuries. And this year you're going to go through, you know, Corona, Chinese virus shutdowns. And if you can withstand that and still come out standing, you know, and it's there forever, it's ingrained forever, and you bond together with those guys. And when you reconnect, it's timeless. And to me, that's what we all strive for, is timelessness in this game, is memories. It's to make an impact and feel value for what you do. And to me, winning doesn't always define it. There's been, that last year, I think the last year in Dayton when we had that rough team because of the owner going bankrupt, and I think I probably coached better than I did the year before when we were in the finals, because I had to be more creative. And I thought of this the other day, this year is going to maybe require that for me as a coach, to be more creative, to think outside the box, to be more hands-on, and to maybe even give more than I gave last year or at any point in Lugano or Owen Sound or Grand Rapids, because of the challenges I'm going to face. So every year brings something new. The fans, you know, it was great that they picked us, but I think they based a lot on what we did last year. And as I said to our guys, this is a new year, new team, new league. Last year means nothing. We have to start all over. We're going to go through our aches and pains. We're going through some now, and I think we're going to use it to get better. That's all I can say.
Coach, looking forward to seeing Hadžibešić Alperija back on the ice. Thanks so much for spending so much time with me. All the best for the future endeavors.
Grazie mille, dankeschön. I appreciate it, and hope to chat again soon.
Unsere Liga. Dein Spiel. Der neue Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League, Bet at Home, hat ein tolles Angebot für alle echten Hockey-Fans. Spiel mit und hol dir jetzt einen Ice Hockey League Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Zusätzlich verlost Bet at Home einmal zwei Tickets für ein Ice Hockey League Spiel deiner Wahl am nächsten Spieltag. Geh einfach auf die Bet at Home Facebook-Seite und schick uns eine Nachricht mit deiner Lieblingsmannschaft. Bet at Home. Das Leben ist ein Spiel. Rechtlicher Hinweis, Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter spielerschutz.eu.
He is the first return guest on this podcast. He's a master of X's and O's, and that's why he's back on. He's the legend that is called Rob Daum, and he's now on Hockey O'Clock. Coach, thanks for taking the time less than almost a month after we did this the very first time.
Yeah, it's been a while. Time flies. Especially in the, actually, time doesn't fly in this day and age. It stands still most of the time.
Right, but there's a very specific reason why we brought you back on, because we kept conversing back and forth whether you'd be interested in breaking down some Bet at Home Ice Hockey League teams play.
Right.
And you gladly agreed. We put it to a vote, and I'm going to get into that very, very shortly. But as a follow-up to the last conversation where we had you on the podcast, what are you up to now? Why did we record the last conversation in Vienna, and why are you now in Budapest?
Well, we recorded the last conversation in Vienna because I was on my way to Budapest. I've accepted a job here with a hockey academy. I'm working as a mentor coach. So basically, they have a program that runs from U8 to U14. They have four teams and six different coaches. And my job is to not work with the athletes, just work with the coaches as far as coaching tips that I might be able to help them with, practice organization, all of anything to do with coaching. And I'm not on the ice directly with the athletes. I will be a little bit later on. But my primary role is to try and help the coaches as much as I can and share some of my experiences with them to hopefully make them a little bit better.
How different is it to go from coaching players to coaching coaches?
Well, it's completely different. It's completely different because, well, it isn't. I mean, you're still teaching. And you're still dealing with individuals, which is always the case. But when you're teaching players, you're basically coaching a team. And when you're coaching a team, there's a much different approach than when you're coaching the individual coaches. There's no comparison from that regard. The teaching itself is very similar, but the scope is totally different. And right now, when you're trying to help someone, when I coach a team, I know exactly what I want to do and I go out and do it. When you're coaching coaches, it's not my job to tell them what to do. My job is to help them learn what might be the best way for them to develop their style that best suits them while still doing all the things that you need to do to be a good coach. So it's very different in that regard.
So a lot of teaching is involved, and teaching and educating usually go hand in hand, and educating is what we want to do with our listeners. We're trying to make this a more or less monthly feature where each and every 4 to 5 weeks we try to break down one team in a very specific regard. And I put this to vote in an online forum, and fans of course elected or selected the most popular club in Austria. It's Klagenfurt, which we got.
Well, for some people maybe.
Well, the numbers do tell a very distinct story, but at the very least in parts of Carinthia, it is the most popular club, and therefore it's not a surprise that it's the first club that we're going to break down a little bit. Klagenfurt, in a couple of sentences, how would you describe their play in general?
Well, I would say in general, I would consider them a conservative team. They're not one that's takes a lot of chances. They're not going to take risks to create opportunities. They're more patient. They're more, they want the opponent to make mistakes without trying to force them to make mistakes. And that's a philosophical viewpoint of their coaching staff, obviously. And they play a man-to-man defense inside their own zone. And that's basically that in general, that's how I would describe them, as more a conservative team and one that doesn't take a lot of chances to create offense.
The defensive imprint or that defensive focus has come in with Petri Matikainen, obviously a Finnish guy. Would you say there's something typically or uniquely Finnish about the way Petri Matikainen wants his team to play? Something reoccurring?
Yeah, I would say that's in general, I would agree with that. I would agree in general that the Finnish coaches are more conservative. But having said that, if you look at the coach in Hungary, who is also Finnish, he has a different philosophy and a different approach. He is a much... He's more, he activates his defensemen more off the rush. He has them jumping into holes in the offensive zone. So he does more things in that regard. But in general, I would say that the Finnish mentality is more of a risk averse mentality than you hate to generalize because there's always exceptions to everything, but because I'm going to generalize, that's what I would say.
Now, after talking back and forth, after I let you know that we're going to talk about Klagenfurt, you wanted to specifically talk about their power play. Why?
Well, because it intrigued me, because I look at their power play statistics and at the time, I think they're 14.6%, something like that. And if you look at the power plays with some of the other teams in the league, some are two or three, almost three times more efficiency. Now, it is early in the season, and power plays tend to go up and down. But I just saw those numbers, and I wanted to see if there was something that I could see that would maybe explain, why that might be the case at this point in the season.
Before we dive deep into what Klagenfurt is actually doing with the man advantage, I have a couple of general questions just to set this up for the listening audience. What to you constitutes a good power play, apart from the numbers?
Well, a good power play is one that keeps the momentum for your team. And by that, I mean you're able to get into the zone, you're able to maintain puck possession, you're able to generate chances, and you score when you need to score a power play goal. those would be the things that I would say in general. What you don't want to have is a power play that gives the other team momentum, because that's too discouraging for your team and too much encouragement for your opponent. So, you know, those are the things that I would look at. The coach's job is to make is to get the team into the offensive zone with a plan, get puck possession in the offensive zone, and then have a general setup, but within which the players have to execute. So that's, you know, that in general, that's what I would say.
Now, once you're in the offensive zone, there are different ways of approaching a power play. How many different sets of play, how many different ways of executing a power play have you got in your quote unquote game book?
Well, I would say two or three. You know, there's, and it's different on 5-on-3 situations, because that's a completely different. There's a lot more things you can you generally do 5-on-3. You have more set plays. You have a different variety of things that you can do. But in general, I think that your principles on the power play 5-on-4 are the same. It's just your setup is a little bit different. And right now in the world of hockey, for whatever reason, almost everyone's using a 1-3-1 setup on the power play. There's lots of good reasons to do that. I think it gives you a variety of different options. Creates different points of attack, and so that seems to be the primary one that I'm going to say 90% of the teams are using all over the world.
At what point did it change, or did it take on momentum to have four forwards on the power play most of the time?
Well, I think it just depends on the makeup of your team. Ideally, I'd like to have, and when I build my team, I'd like to have four defensemen that are capable of playing on the power play, because I think that's advantageous for a couple of reasons. One, it means you have four offensive-minded puck-moving defensemen, which I think if you can have that, it's great. I don't think you want any more than that, but four is good. And usually what happens, I think, is that one of two things: either you don't have the four defensemen that fill that role, or you've got an extra forward that has to be on the power play. Andrew Kozak has to be on the power play in, can I call them Lince?
Sure.
Or they have to be called the Black Wings.
Black Wings 1992.
Black Wings 1992.
And if I want to do it correctly, it's Steinbach Black Wings 1992.
Okay, well, I won't say Lince then, even though they play in Lince. But anyway, so you need Kozak on the power play because he's an offensive player. If he's not on the power play, he's not going to be happy. And he's capable. You know, he's a capable power play guy. And he fills a role on their power play. So if he's not on the power play, he's not going to be happy. So you want to keep him happy. So you throw him out there. And now you've got four forwards on the power play. And so there's a couple of different things that you probably have to take into account he's not going to take Brian Lebler's spot. So you got to find a place for him. And that's probably where he fits best, because he's got a great one-timer, and that's what you need on the power play to be successful. And he fills that role, and he gets his power play time, and that makes him happy. Which, you know, that's a secondary thought, but it's definitely something you have to think about as a coach. You can't just say these are my power play guys and leave Kozak someplace else, because I don't think that's productive for your team.
Now, most of the teams roll out four forwards when going on a man advantage when playing 5-on-4. You said the most common setup now is the 1-3-1. Could you break it down in terms of responsibilities, what you're looking for at each and every position going from the blue line to the net?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. On the blue line, you need two things. And I'll use Salzburg as an example, because everybody knows their personnel pretty well. You've got Dominik Heinrich, who can make plays up top. You've got Taylor Chorney, who has the ability to one time. And I think you have to have a one time shooting option on your power play. If you don't have a one time shooting option, then the production of your power play is going to drop, because the longer you handle the puck before you shoot it, the more time the goalie has a chance to get across and make the save. You need a slot presence, which is Thomas Raffel, as good as anybody in the league. Lebler and Raffel are interchangeable as far as the skill set that they bring. You need a net presence, because when the puck is high, you need someone in front of the goalie. And also someone who can make plays. So he has to have the courage to go in front. And also, if you have to change the shape of your power play, he can still make plays. Gone are the days where you would put your behemoth in front of the net and Zdeno Chara to stand him in front of the net and tee it up. Well, that doesn't happen very often anymore. And then you need the quarterback. And obviously the quarterback in Salzburg is Johnny Hughes, who is as good a passer as there is in the history of the league. And if you look at Linz as another example, they have exactly the same thing with Pichet up top, Kozik looking for the backdoor shots, Yuma Civic dishing the puck off the half wall, Lebler as a slot presence, and then they'll throw somebody else in front to have that net presence when the puck is high. Because what you're looking to do, you're looking to move pucks quickly, open up seams, attack the seams, or get pucks to the net from out top with traffic in front. 80% of the goals on the power play, and this is a statistical fact, start with shots from the point. So if you get that puck through with traffic, something good is probably going to happen for you. And, you know, those are the things that you're looking to try and create on the power play. And you have to get the loose pucks and give yourselves second and third opportunities. And there's a reason to that, too. You have to have a plan for how you want to retrieve loose pucks and deal with that.
Got two more questions regarding the power play in general. If we're talking clean canvas and you can pick one man first for your power play, would it be the quarterback, the all-important one, or are you focusing in on another position?
No, that would be the where I would want to start, because most things, I mean, if you've got a great one-time shooter and nobody can get him the puck, doesn't do you any good. So if you've got all the elements and you're not able to make the plays necessary to create the opportunities, then I think you're wasting your time. So the quarterback, the person who can make those special passes and those type of things is definitely where I would start.
Power play without a screener, possible anymore? Or have goalies become just too good?
No. It's, you have, and I mean, there's skill, screening is a skill. It's not just, oh, I'm going to go screen the goalie. Well, what does that mean? That means you get in front of the goalie. It doesn't mean you stand beside him and tap him on the pads or try and make a deflection. You take his eyes away. You get in front of him and you make it so he can't see. And that's your job. And if you play off to the side, you're not going to be effective on the power play. You might get a rebound because he plays it poorly. But in most cases, you're not going to he's going to catch it in the play stops, or he's going to have no problem seeing the puck. It's not, you need a screener. When the puck is high, you need somebody screening the goaltender. When the puck is in a shooting position, when the puck isn't in a shooting position, you need possession players so they can get the puck. And then once the puck gets high, then you need somebody in front of the net in order to create havoc for the goaltender.
Now, this is a podcast that is audio only, but we're still trying to kind of marry, quote unquote, it to some visuals. You prepared 5 clips that are going to be on pulse24.at/eishockey, or in German, puls24.at/eishockey. And listeners can view it right there. If they, for whatever reason, don't have a second device with them, we try to vividly and visually describe them what's happening. The first 2 clips that we're gonna look at and then we're gonna talk about are 2 clips that set up something KC is doing or could be doing better. You picked a power play goal from Linz. It happened a couple of days back against the Bratislava Capitals. Nice goal from Andreas Christler, but I think it was the action that happened before that made you pick this clip? Why did you bring it along with you?
Well, I brought it along for a couple of different reasons. One, the Black Wings have possession on the one side, which is not Yuma Civic's strong side. So they changed the point of attack to Yuma Civic, where he can play on his forehand and where he is as dangerous as anybody on the league. Bratislava, had they attacked him right away, they probably would have nullified. They had a chance to attack him before he got set. They didn't. And the result was that he was able to gain a little bit of ice. They had a slot presence, which held up, which demanded coverage. And then he made a great saucer pass to Chrysler for the one-timer. And a couple key things on this was obviously the pass by Yuma Civic, but the one-timer. And the clips show, especially when you get behind the goalie, if Chrysler doesn't one-time that puck, the goalie gets over there and makes a save, in all likelihood. And so that's one of the key things on the power play, is to be able to have that one-time option on the back door. And, that was my reasoning of showing that. And that's one of the things that in watching Klagenfurt's power play, I watched, I don't know how many of them, I didn't see any. I saw passes through the seam, but no one-time shots. So the puck went from A to B, and then it went to C, and then it went back to B, and then it went to A again, but there was never any shot. The seam opened up and the pass was there, but because it took too long to get the puck to the net, the power play sort of died on the vine. And that's, I think that's one of the things that, I noticed in the power play. And the other thing is, okay, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, I'm good.
Just out of curiosity, this A to B to C, it happened, still happened a couple years back. When did those passes through a PK box, did become common?
Well,
because you see them all the time now.
Well, because that's the only way you score. That's the only way you score. If you don't get backdoor plays, the majority of the time you score two different ways. You score with a shot from the point and a rebound and a tip and a scramble, or you get a backdoor play with a seam pass to a one timer. If you look at Washington's power play, Backstrom to Ovechkin. I mean, he's got, 700 goals, and he's probably got 695 backdoor one-timers on a pass from Backstrom. So the goalies are so talented that if you give them time, they're going to make those saves. And so I think that's and the other thing that part of it is because of the 1-3-1, that slot presence has opened up that backdoor seam a little bit more, because you have to honor that guy in the middle if he's on his strong side. If he's not on his strong side where he can one-time the shot, he's useless. He's an appendix. I mean, I don't even bother with him. They use him as a bumper. Well, I don't care. You can bumper the puck the whole 2 minutes if you like. Doesn't bother me at all as a coach. But once that guy threatens a shot, then you have to honor him. When you do that, that opens potentially the back door and creates ways to attack. Now, there's other ways to attack as well, and we'll see that on a clip when we talk about Klagenfurt's goal on the power play. But the majority of the time, those are the things. And there's a high tip where you go back door, and then the guy touches it right away, and that there's a high tip out in the slot area, those type of things. So there are other ways, but this is the majority of how the goals are being scored.
To even further set up the part where we then indeed talk about Klagenfurt's power play, you brought along a second clip. It comes from, coincidentally, a game against Klagenfurt, and it was scored on the power play by Taylor Chorney.
Well, it's very similar to the Black Wings clip. They're on the one side. They move the puck to the other side for Hughes. Raffle is out a little bit higher than he normally would be. So that draws a defender, which opens up the backdoor pass to Chorney. And so a very similar goal. Just another example of how being able to use the backdoor to a one-timer creates offensive opportunities. And And Hughes and Yuma Civic are special, you know, they're special players. They're special passers. Now, from a penalty killing perspective, and I won't get into this too much, but the sticks have got to be on the ice. Your job as a penalty killer is to eliminate point shots and take away seam passes. That's your job. And if you're not doing that, you're gonna run into trouble.
Interesting point that you mentioned. The stick has to be on the ice. How much do you hate it as a coach if a player goes on the ice trying to block a shot lane, therefore takes himself out of the play sometimes?
Well, yeah, if he blocks the shot, fine. But if he doesn't, then, you know, you're potentially in trouble. When I coached in Houston, that was Minnesota Wild's farm team, and Jacques Lemaire was the coach in Minnesota. And his whole defensive philosophy, be it penalty killing or 5-on-5, was stick on puck, stick on the ice, stick take the passing away, stick take the offensive ice away from the offensive player. And his teams never hit anybody. You know, they rarely were physical, but their sticks were so active and so smart that they turned pucks over because the offensive players got frustrated and they ended up trying to move pucks past the sticks or through the sticks, and the pucks would turn over. Now, and so when you think about it, when you're playing hockey, why would your stick not be on the ice? Can you give me a good reason why your stick would not be on the ice?
I'm too bad a hockey player to give you a good reason for that.
Well, there's no reason. There's no reason for your stick not being on the ice. And it creates so much pressure on the offensive team just by having your stick on the ice. It takes away so many options subtly that it changes their point of attack. It changes how they want to attack, and it makes them uncomfortable.
We're finally getting to the nitty-gritty. We have three clips about KAC's power play, coincidentally three goals, but maybe within these goals we can also see what could have done, even though it's been a goal, what could have done better, what could have been different. The first goal that we're going to talk about is one that happened very early in the season, was scored by Rock Teacher and set up by Thomas Koch and Lucas Houdam. Lead me through the goal and what you're seeing there.
Well, this goal comes right off a breakout. And the clip got cut off a little bit early, but when the people get to see the clip, you can see that the first pass beats their first forechecker on the breakout. I believe this is a goal against Dornbirn. So, and that's what you want. So what you want on your breakout is you want the first pass to beat the first forechecker. So that's what Klagenfurt does. They do a great job. And you want to, in my opinion, you want to bring the puck up inside through the middle. So you've got, and with two guys. So you've got support at the offensive blue line, because defensive teams are reluctant to hold the line in the middle. They'll hold the line on the outside or they'll attack on the outside, but they're reluctant to do that if you're coming up through the middle lane. And you want to have as many attack players as you possibly can, and that is players that are coming with the puck to be an option at the blue line to get puck possession. Here, they make the first pass inside. They bring the puck up. The second pass beats their second forechecker coming up the middle of the ice. And now you've beaten the first two forecheckers. You've got an odd man rush. They dish the puck to the outside. They hit the late guy coming in. And they end up scoring with a guy all alone in front of the net. He didn't have to take a one-timer because, you know, he had so much time to make a play. And just a really good job of breaking the puck out with speed, with attack options, and then finishing off the rush. And as a coach, you don't care. Yeah, I mean, you don't need 10 passes to score a power play goal. If you want to score off the rush, go ahead. And that's one of the things that I think power plays should focus on more, is trying to score off the rush. Now, conversely, as a penalty killing coach, one of my number one keys is I say to our guys, never get scored on off the rush. Never get scored on off the rush. If we have to come back into our end and defend for whatever reason, we're not going to get scored on, let any other team score off the rush. And obviously Dornbirn didn't do that there, and Klagenfurt capitalized with a good play, and they ended up scoring. And it's hard to score off the rush on a power play because usually the defense doesn't allow that to happen. But they took advantage of the opportunity. They were well prepared to break the puck out in that circumstance, and it ended up being a goal for them.
It's kind of the unwritten golden rule of a power play that the breakout pass, the first one, needs to beat a man. How many or how long does it take to really figure out who the defenseman or forward is to play that pass? Who do you want it to do?
Well, I think if you have a good plan, the pass is simple. So you don't need to have a magician to make the first pass. As long
I'm thinking of the Jamie Frasers, or in Klagenfurt's case, the David Fishers of as well.
Yeah. That's why they're out there. But they're not out there for the first pass. They're out there for the plays in the offensive zone. And I think that Fisher is hurt right now. Is he not in Klagenfurt?
He's.
Okay. Well, let's see if their power play is the same once he gets back healthy and playing, because I think that will dramatically change their power play. But that was the situation on that. And I say, if you have a plan, and again, the coach's job is to get the team into the offensive zone. So you have to have a plan. And then, you watch the video, you determine how the other team's forechecking on the penalty kill, you devise a plan to get into the zone, and then you let your players take over from there.
Interestingly enough that you spoke of you watching the video. Lead me through that game within the game. You're doing something on a power play. They obviously try to react on their penalty killing. How many change-ups do you throw at them?
Well, as many as you need. When I prepare my teams, we'll have 6 or 7 power play breakouts. And we'll practice them at least once a week. So the principles are the same. The first pass has to beat the first forechecker. And we want to try and come up with through the middle of the ice. And we want to have as many attack players as we can. So when we hit the blue line, we've got 4 or 5 guys with speed, so we can give ourselves the best chance to gain the zone. So you put them in place, and then you react when you need to. I mean, you go in with a game plan based on the video, and then if something changes, you make the adjustment like that. And people are going to say, well, if they've got 4 guys back in the neutral zone, and I mean, how do you beat the first forechecker when they're all back? Well, in that circumstance, you drop the puck back to speed, and you beat the first forechecker with your speed coming up the ice.
The fourth clip that you brought along is a goal from Klagenfurt in Székesfehérvár against Fehérvár AV19. Of course, it happened with Thomas Koch on the ice, who's been a power play mainstay his entire career, and a goal was scored by Nick Pedersen. What did you see in that clip?
Well, the difference between, well, Tommy Koch is a left-handed shot. And when you talk about Yuma Civic and Hughes, they're right-handed shots. And because Tom is left-handed, he doesn't have as much ice to look for those seam passes. So what he does in this play is he starts to drive the middle, which draws the defender to him. Now, if I'm the Hungarian defender, I don't worry about Tommy Koch driving to the middle because he's left-handed. So if he's going to get to the middle, in most cases, he's going to be looking for a backhand shot, or he's going to have to draw it through, and you're going to have a chance to react to that and disrupt the play. But the defenseman comes to him, and Koch, being the good player that he is, and Pedersen makes a great play. Pedersen presents his stick on the outside, which is the only place Koch can make the pass. And if I'm the Hungarian defenseman, that's what I know, so I take that away. He doesn't. Koch makes the play, and then Pedersen walks through the seam and ends up putting the puck in the net. Now, as a penalty-killing coach, I wouldn't consider that a good goal, because my goalie's has to be responsible for something on the penalty kill. If they make a backdoor pass with Pedersen, yeah, that's not the goalie's fault. But when he walks out like that and stuffs it, then, you know, I have to tell my goalie that's his responsibility. But Peterson makes a great play. He takes that seam, he drives through, and then he finds a way to get the puck in the net. I think he scored four goals that game. So he was, you know, he's a good player, and he took advantage of that.
Against an decimated Hydro Fehava AVN19 team, to be fair. But let's go back to the role Thomas Koch is playing in this clip. You said he is as a left-handed shot on the left side, which isn't ideal. So obviously he made the best out of a not-so-ideal situation. How do you make sure as a coach that you get him as your primary playmaker, which he still is at 37, kind of, in a better position?
Well, I don't. It depends on the makeup of your power play and the other people you have. The majority, the great thing about Salzburg and Linz is they have right-handed quarterbacks, because everybody else on their power plays is left-handed. So it works perfectly. With Klagenfurt, I think they're all left-handed shots, with the exception of Peterson. And so you want Koch to be the quarterback on the half wall. So that's the price you pay for having four left-handed shots, and your quarterback happens to be left-handed. If you had right-handed shots, you know, you could work things on the other side potentially, depending on how you wanted to work it. I mean, you could work with Peterson backdoor, but when Fisher comes back, you're going to have an additional right-handed shot. But if he's playing up top, that's not going to have as big an impact.
After going through various off seasons with talks to GMs and people who make personnel decisions, they always keep moaning that there are not enough right-handed defensemen on the market. Why is it so tough to get right-handed defensemen and for that matter, maybe right-handed playmakers?
Because there's not that many right-handed shots. I mean, that's a simplification, but it's the reality of it. If you go down the rosters of the teams in the league, probably 75% are left-handed shooters. And so it's, you know, it's not easy to find that other 25%. And anytime you're looking for 25%, now you're looking for the top end of the skill in that 25%. So obviously you have less of that as well. So mathematically, it's just, it's tough.
So how much would a right-handed playmaker help Klagenfurt in creating more variety in their power play?
Well,
I know tea leaves, but still.
Well, I don't know that it necessarily would, because Tommy Koch probably still wants to be the guy. I don't think you would change anything, because you still want Tom probably to be the guy that quarterbacks. The only thing you might do is have other potentially right-handed shots, so you can do a variety of different things and maybe work it from the other side, which opens up the one-timers with right-handed shooters, and it makes it you know, difficult to defend that way. But as far as I still think you would want Tommy Koch being your playmaker, so you wouldn't be looking for a right-handed playmaker. You'd be looking for one right-handed one-timers players, those type of things. Now Peterson obviously can do that. I think he can probably do anything he wants as far as his skill set. So I don't think it would necessarily change things dramatically. The things that I've seen with Klagenfurt's power play is they're not taking one-timer shots. When they create the opportunities, and when they shoot pucks from up top, there's no traffic in front. So there's no traffic.
One last clip that we're going to talk about, the fifth also, that can be found on pulse24.at/icehockeypulse24.at/icehockey. It happened fairly recently. It was the first goal in a 2-1 affair from Klagenfurt against Innsbruck, and was scored by Clemens Unterweger. What did you see in that clip that made you to bring it along?
Well, first of all, Klagenfurt's only scored four power play goals, so if we had to look at ways to get some power play clips where they were able to score. And again, it's off the breakout. And it's similar to the Dornburn in that the first pass beats the first forechecker, and they're bringing the puck up through the middle, and they've got support at the blue line coming with speed, and they've got a number of guys coming with speed. They move the puck to the outside, which allows them to gain possession, which is always the number one priority. The possession forward on the wall makes a seam pass across ice. And there's a little bit of puck handle, and Unterweger comes in and just tees it up. It's a one-timer. And if you look at the clip, especially when you see the back end of it, Sveta can't see anything. There's two guys in front of the net. And that's just a prime example of when you get traffic in front, the goalie can't see it, and good things happen. So that's just an example of getting the traffic in front and creating opportunities because of it. And I'm not trying to be critical of Klagenfurt's power play. It's just the things that I've seen. Now, I didn't watch all their power plays. Maybe the other power plays, they had 15 great chances. I just missed them. So if that's the case, then I apologize.
Now, we've kind of created a blueprint for a successful power play, but in all the things that you mentioned, how important is speed for a good power play?
Well, I think it's really important. I think you want to have I think there's two type of players on the power play. This is my philosophy. There's the possession players. For example, lots of teams will stretch guys and they pass to those long guys and then just tip the puck in, or they get the blue line and they don't attack the zone with speed. And then you have attack players which is what Klagenfurt has done in those two breakout goals we talked about. They're coming with speed with the puck. I think on the power play, you want to have as much speed with the puck, joining the puck, as you can to get inside the zone. And so I think it's very important. Personally, I think it's a key part of gaining the zone on the power play and getting set up.
I want to remain with Klagenfurt for one more question. Obviously, I did intersect with a lot of other general questions, which was initially meant to be Klagenfurt only talk, but I do think it's important for the understanding of a power play. Not that we're in a position to tell Klagenfurt how to deal with their power play, but if you had to put your finger on two or three things that you'd adjust if you were the coach, what would that be? Just to summarize it for all the Klagenfurt fans listening.
Well, I don't know that there's things that when your power play is struggling, then you have to look at a couple of different things. Is your setup proper? Is it the proper setup? Have you got guys in the right place? Are you practicing the power play enough? Are you practicing? And these are questions that I can't answer, obviously. Are you practicing it in a variety of different ways? Are you practicing it from face-offs? Are you practicing it from entries? Are you practicing it from dump-ins where there's a loose puck and everybody has to go back and get the puck, penalty killers and power play? Do you practice that? Or do you just set it up and say, you know, let's work from control? Because you have to practice from all different facets if you want to improve your power play. So I'm not going to... And then the next question you have to ask, do the people you have on your power play have the skill set to execute at a high level? And I mean, that's just the questions that you ask when the power play and power play struggle. Like Klagenfurt might go 50% in the next four or five games. And it's a strange thing. It's inexplicable. And there were times when I was coaching where, you know, we'd quit practicing the power play because it was struggling so much, and then all of a sudden it would turn itself around. You know, it's a mystery. But I think if you have to, you know, be prepared to practice it in a variety of different ways, so you give yourself the best chance to execute under all different circumstances.
Which leads me to the last question regarding the power play. Usually it's 5 versus 4, but how often do you practice those special teams? 5 versus 3. Past weekend we saw 4 versus 3, 6 versus 5 when the net is empty. How often does that happen?
Well, I think you have to be prepared for those things. I think as a coach, you should practice your 5-on-3 as often as you practice your 5-on-4, because I mean Yeah, I mean, I think you should. And the 4-on-3, not quite as much because you have a limited amount of time. And if you're spending too much time working on your 4-on-3, which is what percentage of the power plays, you're wasting your power play practice time on something you don't see enough. But I think you have to have a general plan for those circumstances. 5-on-3, 5-on-4, I think you practice the same amount. And then the goalie pulled.
6-on-5.
Yeah, the goalie pulled. You have to have a plan for that. And similar situation, you want to practice that. Again, not as much as the others, but you should have a plan, and your team should be prepared to execute under those circumstances. And you are limited with your time. So, you know, if your power plays at 50%, you're probably not going to have too many 6-on-5s. You're probably in pretty good control of your games.
Now, this has been really interesting in terms of the power play, and hopefully Kaatsi fans got their listening time worth or made worthwhile. Just to let listeners know what other parts of the game you can break down, or put it differently, is there anything as regards hockey that you can't break down?
Me personally or anybody?
You personally.
Well, I don't think so.
There you go.
And I don't say that. I mean, that sounds pretty arrogant and self-serving, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, I've been around the game for 40 years. There's not an infinite number of things that happen in a game. Like you can go 5 years and not see something different. I've built a playbook over my time that sort of looks at every, what I would do is at the end of each year, I would evaluate the things that I saw through the course of that year and then come up with a plan to, if I ever face that again, that this is what we'll do. So over 40 years or 35 years or whatever it is, there's not too many things that you haven't seen. And if I've seen it, I got some sort of a plan to help defeat it. And again, please don't take that as arrogance, because I consider myself a student of the game. I take pride in it. And there'll be something that'll happen tomorrow that I've never seen, and I'll have to think of something to do.
But this has been a setup, because obviously I want listeners back home to know that they can pose almost any question, that you are going to break down almost any scheme if requested next time around. Obviously, it's not going to be Klagenfurt anymore. So if there is interest from users in their team and they want you to break it down and talk a little bit about it on the podcast, this is what we're going to do 4 to 5 weeks from now.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Coach, thank you so much for educating us on power play and the Kaatsi's power play specifically. Talk to you soon again for your third appearance on Hockey O'Clock.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it. Hopefully people get something out of it.
Der Leitspruch von Hockey O'Clock ist simpel. Von einem Hockeyfan für Hockeyfans. Darum. Habt ihr Fragen, Anregungen oder Wünsche für Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner? Jederzeit her damit. hockeyoclock101@gmail.com ist eure Anlaufstelle für all diese Dinge und noch viel mehr. hockeyoclock101@gmail.com. Und sollte euch der Podcast gefallen, dann freue ich mich über eine positive Bewertung. Überall dort, wo ihr Hockey O'Clock hört.
Bei Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner darf natürlich ein Teil nicht fehlen, und das ist der fixe Teil mit dem Puls 24 Experten, der Puls 24 Expertin. Dieses Mal ist es natürlich beim Trainer Only Talk bzw. Trainer Only Podcast Greg Olds. Greg, erst einmal schön, dass du dir die Zeit nimmst.
Martin, good to have a day. Nice to be here.
Coach, wenn wir nur Trainer im Podcast haben, musst natürlich auch du mit dabei sein. Zu welchem Zeitpunkt deiner Karriere hast du gewusst, ich werde Trainer?
Eigentlich, das war wirklich nach meiner Laufbahn. So, ich habe gespielt bis courts for my Neunerdreißig Geburtstag in Graz. Dann nachher habe ich gespielt zweite Liga bis Linzburg, dritte Liga bis 41. Dann war ich Trainer in Wattens. Das war der erste Profiteil. Wenn ich zurückdenke, in 1993 habe ich aufgehört als Spieler. Und dann war ich in Kelowna. Ich habe übersiedelt von Montreal nach Kelowna, British Columbia. Und ich war 39. Und ich habe angefangen mit Kindern zu arbeiten, um 6 bis 8 Uhr in der Früh vor der Schule. Weil ich war immer gut mit jungen Leuten. Und ich habe 6 oder 7 Kinder gehabt. So ich habe eigentlich Geld verloren, nur technische Sachen gearbeitet. Und dann habe ich 10 gehabt, und dann 12, und dann auf einmal habe ich die zwei Stunden waren voll. Ich sagte, okay, so das ist ein bisschen Geschäft, ich verdiene $100 oder was. Das Problem war, um 8:30 war ich bei McDonald's frühstücken mit meinem Kollegen, und mein Tag war eigentlich fertig. I said, was tue ich jetzt? So nach Eishockey, das war wirklich hart. Für ein paar Jahre, was mache ich jetzt? Ich bin ein Eishockeyspieler. Ich habe mein ganzes Leben gespielt. Das war eine harte Phase. Und dann habe ich Eishockeyschule erfunden. Oder ich habe angefangen mit der Eishockeyschule. Und dann haben wir 4 Wochen gehabt in der Sommer. Aber vor dieser Schule, Kelowna Minor Hockey hat mich angerufen. Greg, bist du interessiert, Trainer zu sein? Also ja, vielleicht. Bei welcher Alter? Bantam. Das ist 14, 15-Jährige. Ich sagte, okay. Was ich habe gewusst, ich habe einen guten Namen gehabt. Ich war ein guter Spieler. Und ich habe eine gute Ahnung. Und ich war gut mit jungen Leuten. Angeblich haben die Series gehört. Ich sagte, oh, okay, so die Top-Mannschaft. Nein, du bekommst die zweite Mannschaft. So Bantam B, nicht Bantam AAA. Ich sagte, well, wer mag die Top-Mannschaft? Ja, eine, was wir gefeuert haben, weil war abusive mit den Kindern und so, aber wir geben ihm noch keine Chance. Ich sagte, okay, whatever. Aber wir wollen, dass du gehst. So, das war mein erster wirklich Coaching-Assignment. Das war 1995. Bantam Team, Kelowna, British Columbia. Der zweite Teil von den Spielern, so the B-Mannschaft. Und sie haben gesagt, du gehst, aber wenn du das nehmen willst, du musst in der B-League gehen, nicht in der Top-AAA-League.
Also du musst das wirklich ganz unten anfangen.
Nein, du musst in der zweite Liga gehen, nicht in der Top, nicht gegen die erste Kelowna-Mannschaft in Kamloops, die waren die arrogante Stars, wirklich. Das war... Ich sagte, nein, Moment. So, du willst, dass du die zweite Mannschaft nimmst, aber in der zweiten Liga, so die B-League, nicht die AAA-League, weil da glaubst du, ich habe eine Chance zum Gewinnen. Ja. Ich sagte, nein. Wenn ich das Job übernehme, ich gehe in die beste League, was möglich ist, mit der zweiten Gruppe, und da werden wir einen Haufen lernen. So ich sagte, oh, sie haben es diskutiert und eventuell haben sie ja gesagt. Well, guten Morgen, das war ein harter Kampf. Eh? So das ist, was ich wollte. Ich wollte diese Spieler nehmen, die Outcasts from the erste Gruppe. Und wir spielen in der Top League. Ich habe eine Sitzung mit den Eltern gehabt. Alle Eltern, wie wir das machen, guys, es ist going to be schwer. Wir können in der B-League spielen und vielleicht in der Top 2 sein, oder wir gehen in der Top-League und wir werden kämpfen gegen die Besten. Aber es wird nicht einfach. Seid ihr alle dabei? I got the guys, Brad, my pair co-trainers, super guys. Ihr bleibt ruhig, drink your wine, have your beers. Wenn du ein Problem hast, komm zu mir. So ich habe die Familie von Elton und alle im Griff gehabt. Erstes Spiel in Kamloops. Ersin the Little versus him. This is a top matchup. Top team. Top team. Top spieler. Arrogante Gruppe. Ersin the Little versus Zweinol Hinton. You've heard us nie vergessen. Nicht schlecht. Nach der zweiten Drittel waren wir 8-0 hinten. Und sie haben angefangen, arrogant sein, die Spieler. Ich habe es gemerkt am Eis. So, ich bin auf die Eis ausgegangen, nach der zweiten Drittel, nicht auf die hintere Gang. Die Spieler vorbei. Einfach so. Aber ich hab etwas gespürt. Sie haben ihre Schläger umgedreht, upside down. Hey, wir sollen mit unseren Schlägern upside down spielen gegen diese Truppe. Holy fuck, die waren arrogant. Tut mir leid. Ich gehe in meine Kabine. Meine Spieler sitzen alle da, ziemlich weiß im Gesicht. Das war brutal. Der junge Trainer kommt im Gang. Und wir waren nicht weit voneinander, so 2 Meter. Was auf einmal war ein paar Zentimeter. Und ich habe zu ihm gesagt, ich sage, hey, ihr seid eine super Truppe. Vielleicht wir sind nicht so gut. Aber wenn deine Spieler sagen, sie spielen mit den Schlägern upside down, das ist tough für meine Spieler. Er hat mir gesagt, Gesicht zu Gesicht, we could have blown you guys out in the first fucking period. I said, you... Ist es wurscht, was ich gesagt habe.
Ja, natürlich.
Wir waren Gesicht zu Gesicht.
Also darfst du das hier auch fluchen am Podcast?
I said, you fuck you, you son of a bitch, arrogant prick. Deine Spieler sind genauso wie du. Well, meine Spieler waren in, sie haben das alles gehört. Und ich war laut genug, dass sie das hören. Ich habe einen Grund gehabt hinter das. Ich bin eingegangen und meine Spieler waren wirklich jetzt noch weißer im Gesicht. I said, guys, ihr geht an die Eis, macht das Spiel fertig, give it all you got. Wir haben 6-0 verloren. 6-0. Ich kam aus, die Helden waren alle da. Und ich habe gesagt, guys, ich habe gesagt, das wird nicht einfach sein. So, let's move ahead. Okay, schnell. Ich habe eine Truppe gehabt. Quinn hat gehabt. Ein Ohrring, orangen Haar. Kenny McGowan. Er war lang und schlank wie ein junger Ei. Kenny war noch ein Superspieler in Deutschland. Einer von den besten Spielern. Kenny McGowan. I got Quinn. Ich habe so eine Gruppe von Castoffs und Lustig. Aber, boy, these guys, they were my Familie. Wir waren auf einmal so eng zusammen, eh? Okay, I'm going to go ahead 2 Monate jetzt. 1.5 oder 2 Monate später, Eric Lindros, das Top NHL-Spieler, sein Neffe oder Jung Cousin oder irgendetwas in seinem Familienkreis, er war 15 Jahre alt, auch auf dieser Mannschaft in Kamloops, und er ist gestorben. Er hat irgendetwas mit einer Krankheit gehabt und er ist überraschend gestorben. And a tragedy, horrible. Well, meine Spieler, I said, boys, we're having an Angriff und sofort, we're having a Karte, alles unterschrieben, geschickt sofort to the Mannschaft. I mean, Eishockey is this, but this is traurig. 2 Monate später, wir haben gegen diese gleiche Mannschaft gespielt, noch diese schlimme Fall. This is 2 Monate, and wir haben gearbeitet, hard training, boom, guys, es ist wie etwas. And wir haben verloren. 5-2. So from 6-0 auf 5-2. Und der Trainer hat noch gesagt, hey guys, big improvement, super. Und hey, thanks for the card. So du siehst, was der Respekt weg vom der Halle ist. Wir können schreien miteinander. Aber wenn Sachen im Leben passiert, so wie wir leben jetzt in der Covid-Welt, Gesundheit für Menschen, ältere Leute, was sterben, das ist so eine Tragödie. So du siehst, das war ein Teil von der Entwicklung von unseren Spielern und mir auch. Was passiert ist. Und wir sind dann auf einmal, ich habe 2, 3 Spieler nicht bekommen von die erste Mannschaft in Kelowna. Meine eigene Gruppe. Weil der Trainer wollte nicht, dass ich die Spieler bekomme. Dass vielleicht wir können sie schlagen. Und einmal habe ich einen Angriff bekommen und gesagt, hey, ein Spieler hat mich angerufen. Er hatte Probleme gehabt, vielleicht Alkohol und so. Und er war bei der Eishalle sitzen ganz allein. Und ich habe ihn geholt. Und heimgebracht. Er hat Probleme daheim gehabt und trinken. Und so ich habe ihn geholt und eventuell wir haben ihn bekommen. Und als die Truppe war wirklich, das Film The Bad News Bears, I'm talking The Bad News Bears. We were having so viel Spaß gehabt. And then the Eltern haben gespürt, and he were full with energy. And diese Gruppe auf einmal, they waren alle wie meine Kinder. Es war unwahrscheinlich.
Und das war der Punkt, wo du dir gedacht hast, Coaching, das wird der Rest meines Lebens sein?
Nein, überhaupt nicht. Absolut nicht. So, die Saison geht weiter, wir waren letzter Platz mit einer anderen Mannschaft, so ungefähr letzte. Auf einmal rutschen wir auf fünfte Platz vom neun vielleicht sowas. Nur auf fünfte, aber ein Fortschritt gemacht. Und wir haben noch hier in dieser Tourneeform gespielt in Kelowna Minor. Zwei oder drei Tournee, Double A, so eine Gruppe unter der Triple A. Eigentlich, wo wir gehören vom Anfang an. Und wir haben diese Tournee gewonnen. So das bedeutet, dass wir haben etwas gespürt, die Spieler, weil wir haben in der besten Liga gespielt. So dann kommt der Sack und wir spielen gegen Kelowna das zweite Mal. Das erste Mal war nicht gut. Das zweite Mal gegen Kelowna. Not the big boys, the stars. Wir haben 4-1 verloren und das Spiel, wir waren eigentlich besser. Und da haben die Spieler schönen Respekt bekommen von den Boys. Wir haben 4-1 verloren. Torchance genug zum Gewinnen oder unentschieden spielen. Wir waren eine schöne, stolze Gruppe. Okay, so die Saison geht vorbei. Meine Frau damals, Christine, sie war drin. Brad, Mooner, meine zwei Assistenten. Paul Mitchell, einer von den Top Lawyers in Colonials. Wir sind immer noch befreundet. War der Manager. Saison-Tourman. Und ich rede nach der Saison mit der Familie in einem Restaurant. Und ich stehe auf. Das war die Abschlussgespräch. Noch dieses Jahr. Und ich stehe auf mit den Spielern, sitzen vor mir und die Eltern im Restaurant. Und ich stehe auf zum Reden. Und ich konnte nicht reden. Ich konnte kein Wort sagen. Auf einmal habe ich Tränen in meine Augen gehabt. Ich habe wirklich geweint. Ich bin aus dem Restaurant gegangen für 2-3 Minuten. Deep breath. Wieder zurück eine. Wenn ich jetzt denke daran, ich könnte jetzt Tränen haben. Weil diese Spieler, they're my boys. This is my guys. Das habe ich schon gewusst, da habe ich schon Kontakt mit den Kindern. Und habe ich geredet, boom, es war moving, it was moving. Es war, wie sagt man moving in Deutsch, es war
bewegend.
Und bis dieser Tag, wenn ich manche Spieler sehe von dieser Mannschaft, Kenny McGowan, Jared Starks, alle wie sie heißen, Holzi, how you doing, buddy? Weil die waren alle noch in meiner Eishockey-Schule. Und dann nach diesem Jahr habe ich meine Eishockey-Schule gegründet. Sie sind alle gekommen. Auf einmal von Kelowna Minor. Ich habe in 4 Wochen 300 Kinder gehabt in meiner Schule. Und ich war nicht da, weil ich war bei einem Turnier oben in Banff. Ich habe Coach of the Year bekommen in Kelowna Minor Hockey und wir waren 5. oder 6. Platz. So, ist das nur gewinnen oder ist das Menschen helfen, Entwicklung, Leidenschaft zu deinem Spieler, Leidenschaft zu den Eltern? Als eine Gruppe, wir haben so viel Spaß gehabt. Es ist unglaublich.
Ich muss zwei Dinge hier klarstellen. Einerseits, warum machen wir das Interview auf Deutsch? Das letzte Mal im Podcast warst du auf Englisch zu Gast, auf vielfachen Wunsch der Userinnen und User. Deswegen haben wir dieses Mal gesagt, wir bringen auch dein hervorragendes Deutsch jetzt mal zum Vorschein. Das andere ist, normalerweise gibt's an dieser Stelle immer den Wochenendrückblick auf die Bet at Home Eishockey League Action. Wir wollen es aber heute wirklich tatsächlich nur beim Thema Coaching und alles, was damit zu tun hat, behalten. Das sind deine ersten Schritte gewesen im Coaching-Bereich. Es ist dann in Richtung große Coaching-Karriere auch gegangen. Aber vielleicht mal ganz allgemein. Was ist ein guter Coach? Beziehungsweise was muss ein guter Coach machen?
Human element. Can we say in English? For me, I say the human element. This is respect, Freundschaft, junge Leute, ältere Profis, helfen in ihrem Leben, nicht nur am Eis. Mein Tor ist und war immer offen für Spieler. Der Trainer muss hart sein, aggressiv sein, fair sein, böse sein, nett sein, A, B, C, D. Das ist ein ganzer Kreis von verschiedenen Gefühlen. Manche Spieler machen das, brauchen eine harte Hand, manche brauchen Hilfe. Ich glaube, dass du musst ehrlich sein, Nummer eins, ehrlich, 100% ehrlich sein. Aber du musst hart sein, du musst ein bisschen tough love auch haben. Und bei Training, du musst hart trainieren. Du musst schnell trainieren, du musst hart trainieren und du musst richtig trainieren. Das bedeutet, good habits sind so wichtig. Wie du trainierst, wie du spielst. Okay, so das ist, ich glaube das wirklich. Aber für mich, ich habe meine Spieler geliebt, ich schwöre. In Villach oder wo ich war, I love my players. Sie haben mich nicht alle geliebt, das weiß ich. That, but this is a wurscht. I love my players, they don't have to love me. Und ich mag alles, was ich konnte, auch mit meinem verschiedenen Stil, nett sein, böse sein, ist a wurscht, privat, Café, go for a beer, dass ich diese Spieler helfen konnte. Weil ich habe immer gesagt, guys, du hast mehr, wie du glaubst. Und wenn Eishockey ist vorbei, du wirst es vermissen. Glaub mir. Du wirst die Kabine vermissen. This is the boys. This is Leben. Ich habe das vermisst. Brutal. Habe 2 Jahre gedauert. Ehrlichkeit ist Nummer eins. Glaubwürdigkeit. ABCD. Integrity. Du musst ein guter Human Being sein für deinen Spieler. Und so denke ich, das ist ganz wichtig. Du kannst super trainieren. Super Socken, aber wenn die Spieler glauben, dass du bist ein bisschen linker Hund, ist es vorbei. Es ist nur eine Frage der Zeit, bis du gefeuert bist.
Jetzt fallen Coaching-Talente recht selten vom Himmel. Jeder hat so Influencer along the way, würde ich jetzt sagen. Wer war für dich, und gab sicher viele Einflüsse von vielen verschiedenen Leuten, aber wer war für dich, für deine Trainerkarriere am einflussreichsten?
Ron Kennedy.
Warum?
Well, in 1995 habe ich das Mannschaft gehabt in Kelowna. Oh, wann war das? 1998, na 97 vielleicht, ich weiß nicht ganz genau. Ron Kennedy war mit Joe Meehan bei der AWM irgendwo. Sie haben gewusst, dass ich arbeite gut mit jungen Leuten. Und sie haben mich angerufen, ob ich Interesse hätte, mit den U-Ochsen, U-20, das österreichische Nationalteam zu arbeiten. Okay, das war nicht viel Geld drin, aber gute Basis, warum bist du interessiert, deine Entwicklung, whatever, und Assistant Coach mit Ron, bei dem Nationalteam. Und ich habe ein paar Tage gebraucht, über das gedacht, ich sagte, okay, guys, this is eher der Anfang, wirklich, die nächste Stufe von meinem Coaching, weil nach die Bantams habe ich gemacht, nur meine Eishockey-Schule. Ich war nicht mehr Trainer nach diesem Jahr. Ich habe nur meine Schule gemacht. Und dann habe ich das genommen, U-Ochsen. Und komischerweise, ein paar Leute haben gedacht, der Holz ist ein guter Spieler, aber er kann nie Trainer sein. Und sie waren mit uns ein Top-Arzt-Freund da. Und sie waren alle überrascht, wie ich war mit dem U-Ochsen-Nationalteam. From, hey boys, look, we're schlumpig. Let's get Anzugs on. Let's look profi. This was super. Wir haben alle knocked. Unser Dresscode gechanged. Boom, wie wir denken, wie wir reden. Und dann sind alle zusammen gerutscht, gemeinsam. Alle zusammen. Es gibt einen Grund, guys. Es gibt einen Grund. A, B, C, D. Sie haben das gefolgt. Wir haben Erfolg gehabt. Und wir haben Spaß gehabt. Und bis dieser Tag, diese ganze U-Ochsen, Leute, Marco, Peval, Koch, alle, wie sie heißen, wir haben immer noch Kontakt. So was war das? Das war, change your dress code, feel good, look good, feel good, play good. Hey, manieren, take care of yourself, good to Kamerad sein, ich war ehrlich mit den Burschen, and we practice hard. And this, Ron Kennedy and Joe haben mir, Joe Meehan und diese Richtung haben mir wirklich geholfen, or the chance gegeben. Aber Ron Kennedy war für mich der wichtigste, und er war ein super Trainer, ein super Freund, und der Geschichte ist schade, muss ich ganz ehrlich sagen.
Geht natürlich um die Krebserkrankung, den viel zu früh verstorbenen Ron Kennedy. Wir werden an einem anderen Punkt, so viel kann ich schon vorwegnehmen, dann im Laufe der Podcast-Saison auch ein bisschen ausführlicher über Ron Kennedy sprechen, dessen Name ja nach wie vor die MVP-Trophy prägt. Aber eine Geschichte noch zu deinem Coaching. Du hast gesagt, Ehrlichkeit, Glaubwürdigkeit sind extrem wichtig. Aber welcher Ratschlag, what piece of advice hat dir beim Coaching von jemand anderem immer geholfen? Gibt's da was?
Eigentlich, du musst dir gut überlegen, das ist, ich habe meine eigene Ideen immer gehabt. Ich habe von Ron viel gesehen, viel gelernt, wie er mit dem Nationalteam war, wie er trainiert hat, so vom Übungen her und so. Ich habe Sachen genommen von mir, wie er redet und alles, aber ich habe meinen eigenen Plan, ich habe meinen eigenen Kopf. Aber Ron Kennedy hat mir einmal gesagt, er hat ein paar Sachen gesagt. Wenn du bist ein guter Trainer, never be scared to get fired. Because if you get fired, du bist traurig für ein oder zwei Tage, du bekommst den nächsten Job. Und das ist unglaublich wahr. Wenn du schaust die NHL zum Beispiel, es ist ein Kreis. Never be afraid to get fired. Das ist ganz wichtig. Er hat auch gesagt, wenn du bist Trainer in der Profimannschaft in Europa, du holst Ausländer und Sachen. Du musst wissen über die Frau, die Familie. Du musst wissen über die Privatsachen, weil es ist ganz wichtig. Weil eine Mannschaft, die Kabine ist alles. Der Erfolg ist wirklich in der Kabine. Nicht der Trainer in der Kabine, die Kabine selber. Das ist der Erfolg. Der Trainer, so wie ihr, Ronny, wir steuern nur das Kabine, mehr nicht. Wenn wir zu oft in dieser Kabine sind, ist es tödlich. Oder es ist so viel Spaß, dass ich muss meinen Kopf immer eine tun. Because I'm a player. I'm a player at heart. Don't be afraid to get fired. Pick the right players. So wichtig. Ron hat mir das beigebracht. Ganz wichtig. Und ich habe immer gewusst, ich habe schon viel gelernt. Ich habe immer hart trainiert. Ich weiß nicht warum. Immer schnell und hart. Vielleicht, weil ich habe in meiner Spielerkarriere, ich habe überall beobachtet, verschiedene Sachen, zum Beispiel von verschiedenen Trainern, wie wir trainiert haben, was hat mir nicht gepasst als Spieler. So, I have ein paar gute Sachen, aber viel Exes. Na, das mag ich nicht, das mag ich nicht, das mag ich nicht. So, dann habe ich mein eigenes Gehirn gesteuert, wie ich will trainieren, wie hart, wie lang, wie kurz. Aber in Endeffekt, mein erster wirklich Engagement in Villach, ich habe immer versucht, Trainer zu sein. Ich bin ein Spieler. Was will ich heute? Wie hart will ich wirklich trainieren? So, ich habe immer gedacht, okay, jetzt bin ich ein Spieler. Ich bin der Trainer. Okay, what do I need today? So, ich habe wirklich trainiert, ob ich ein Spieler war. Und das war mein in meinem Kopf. Ich weiß nicht, ob du verstehst, was ich meinst. It's a little tricky. Aber I was a player coach, but I was a player coaching players.
Jetzt gibt es viele Trainer, die vielleicht nie so wirklich die große auch Spielerkarriere hatten. Wie du, kann einem sowas fehlen oder wie wichtig ist es tatsächlich für dich? Ich meine, du hast es gerade beschrieben, es war ja für dich extrem wichtig, Spieler gewesen zu sein, um dann auch als Trainer zu funktionieren. Aber kann es auch mit einer Trainerkarriere funktionieren, ohne dass man Spieler auf hohem Niveau war?
Ja, du kennst, Hitchcock und verschiedene Leute haben nie gespielt und so. Es gibt sicher, ich glaube für mich ist es wichtig, dass ich ein Spieler war. Nach einer Niederlage, nach einem Sieg, nach einer harten Zeit, nach einer schlechten Wette, irgendetwas. Ich habe immer gedacht als Spieler, okay, jetzt bin ich ein Spieler, ich habe das erlebt. Okay, wir haben zweimal verloren, aber wir haben wirklich heute alles gegeben. So wenn der Trainer kommt rein und schimpft wie ein Tepp, ist es falsch. So ich habe gespürt, okay, ich bin jetzt ein Spieler, wir sind in einer harten Phase. Das hat mir viel geholfen, weil ich habe gedacht, okay, jetzt, wir sind in einer Situation, was nicht angenehm ist, oder eine super Situation. Was will ich als Spieler? Und ich habe Trainer gesagt zu mir, okay, Greg, du hast kein Tor geschossen heute, deswegen haben wir verloren. Das war in der Zeitung. Oder this or that. Und manchmal habe ich ein super Spiel gehabt, super. Pullis gewonnen, Schuss blockiert, aber keine Punkte gemacht, aber defensiv alles gemacht. Steht in der Zeitung, schlecht gespielt. Und das hat mich gestört, weil ich habe manchmal ich hab stolz genommen in mein defensiv Teil vom Spiel, aber ich war einfach bekannt als Offensivspieler. Und wenn ich war 35, Barrick war ein Check-Coach. Er hat gute Sachen gemacht, ja. Aber Marketing nicht so gut. Aber ich habe meine Statistik daheim, nur dass du weißt, das Spiel, okay. Und ich habe das daheim bis dieser Tag. Wenig Leute wissen das. Ich habe meine Kinder gezeigt. Ich habe, ich glaube, 20 Tore geschossen, whatever, nicht schlecht. Aber ich war plus 41, Nummer 1 auf der Mannschaft, weit entfernt. Und ich habe mehr Stolz an diese Statistik gehabt wie viele andere Statistik. Und Leute, ihr wissen das nicht, wie ich gedacht habe. So ich habe alles mein Spielerkarriere schon integriert mit, wie bin ich als Trainer. Was hat mir nicht gepasst vom anderen Trainer? Hey, guys, we lose, ich bin schuld. Ihr gewinnt, ihr seid schuld. Und das habe ich wirklich gedacht. Ich habe nicht gesagt, hey, du hast kein Tor geschossen. Nah, this is a fucking blitzen. Tut mir leid. I love my players. Ich habe alles gemacht. Boah, ich habe hart in viel Ack für diese Jahre. Das war ein harter Kampf. Das war nicht. Wir waren viermal Finale in fünf Jahren. Das war ein Krieg mal mit manchen Spielern. Puh.
Auch über diese Dinge. Und vor allem dann das Championship in Villach 2005, 2006 ja. Werden wir noch ausführlich sprechen. Jetzt ist es ja oft so, dass das Trainerkarriere natürlich in Erfolgen, Siegen, Titeln gemessen werden. Aber wenn wir ein ganz klein wenig ans andere Ende gehen, was war so vielleicht die dunkelste Stunde für dich als Trainer? Was war vielleicht auch die größte Niederlage?
Oh, das ist eine gute Frage. Mein erstes Jahr in Villach, ich hätte zählen sehen, mein erster wirklich, ich war in der zweiten Liga in Wattens, ich war Trainer, aber jetzt bin ich in der ersten Liga. Zählen sehen oder Villach? Ein Jahr davor, Villach war Meister, Ron Kenny war Trainer, zählen sehen war Letzter. So vom Geld her ungefähr gleich, weil damals war nicht so viel Geld. Villach war in ein bisschen Krise mit Geld und alles. Und ich sagte, ja, ich nehme Villach, ein guter Villach. Guter Villach. Die ersten 9 Spiele, glaube ich, haben 2-mal gewonnen. Gut, die Spieler waren ein bisschen arrogant, ein bisschen cocky. Sie waren Meister. Wer bist du, Trainer? Du bist mit U-Ochsen. Du bist ein Junior-Coach. What the fuck you want? Das Gefühl habe ich gehabt. Die Zuschauer waren brutal. Ich konnte nicht ausgehen für Bier, wirklich. Ich konnte nicht ausgehen für Bier in Villach. Weil Peter Raffa war mit mir und er kann das bestätigen. He said, holy fuck, this is brutal. So then, Joe Mian and the president hold me in. And she said, okay, Holstein, du hast 3 Spiele. Du bekommst 3 Spiele von uns. I said, ja, wie viel muss ich gewinnen? Alle 3. Sonst bin ich gefeuert. Und das war in der Zeit, ich habe die Clips daheim, ich habe alles daheim. Es ist nicht alles rose in meiner Karriere, glaub mir. Okay, so wir haben einen Tausch gemacht und ich habe nur einen Tausch gemacht in meiner ganzen Karriere in Villach. Und ein anderer Spieler, so Ryan Foster, wir haben ihn getauscht, weil er hatte Kreuzweg gehabt und Probleme und es war eine Liste von Sachen. Aber er ist ein guter Bursch, netter Mensch, alles. Hat nicht gepasst, aber wir haben Sean Sumser geholt, so er hört den News Canadian. So wir haben, okay, sie haben es, okay, Peter Raffel kommt an Bord. Ist dein Beobachter. Ich sage, was? Und Peter sagt, ich bin nicht der Beobachter, ich helfe dir. So, wir haben nach diesem Gespräch Training gehabt in Steindorf. Nicht in Villach, alle Team goes down. Die Boys, alle wie sie heißen, ist sie wurscht. Der Peter Raffel ist eingegangen und er sagt zu den Spielern, ich sage, guys, wenn der Holste ist gefeuert oder weg, nicht glauben, dass ich bin dein Trainer. Okay? I'm just gonna let you guys fucking know. Ich bin hier, Greg, zum Helfen, sonst nicht. Wir sind am Eis gegangen und wir haben dieser Tag brutal hart trainiert. I mean, tough. Wir stehen jetzt auf, Olli. Der Foster hat mich auch gefragt. Hoji, can I practice? You guys, come on, Fazi, it's okay. It's a business. Wir haben so hart trainiert. Okay, mein drei Spiel, bist du bereit? Overtime, penalty shots, overtime, alle drei gewonnen. So knapp war das. So dünn war mein Eis. Kommt es von Gott? Kommt es, weil ich war ein ehrlicher Mensch? Von was kommt es?
Aber trotzdem, darkest hour, dieses Ultimatum.
Ist es a dark hour? Well,
naja, also das Ultimatum gestellt bekommen.
Ultimatum gestellt. I said, ooh. Tough. Und dann haben wir Finale erreicht. In sechs Spiele haben wir gegen Linz verloren, wegen einem schlechten Wechsel, weil das Siegestor gegen uns. So das ist wie, das ist eine ganz andere Geschichte. Wir haben das Finale erreicht. Nächstes Jahr, ein bisschen Tiefpunkt, was du redest. Ich komme zurück. Ja, die ganze Jahr ist up and down, ist ein Kampf, ist ein Krieg, was sei. Es ist up and down. Ich bin nett, ich bin geliebt, ich bin gehasst. Das ist die Trainerposten. Vielleicht ist es anders jetzt, aber damals war es tough. Wir sind vor der Playoffs. Management hat viel eingemischt, den hin und her. I said, okay, guys. Und irgendwie, das war ein bisschen Dunkelpunkt. Irgendwie hat der Vorstand in meinem Kopf tun, dass manche Leute wollten, dass ich gehe. Ich weiß nicht, ich glaube, es stimmt nichts. Und ich sagte, okay, glaubst du das wirklich? Ich sagte, okay, sitzen, guys, let's go. Das war vor der Playoff. Vor der Playoff oder ein paar Wochen oder whatever. Oder drei Wochen. Platzierung war okay, wir kommen in die Playoff. Ja, aber sitzen, kommen mit der Mannschaft. I said, guys, okay, Lancey, Crumpy, Ollie, Sitson, Casper, all the guys are there. Stewie, everybody. I said, okay, Surly, tough guys. Tough. Knock this year, I've been back. I'm out of here. Last year, finale, heuer, space day, good. I said, warum? Weil ich will nicht im Weg stehen von einem von euch, this is factual, von Lancey, Crumpy, you, Boom, Casper, Stewie, anyway. Ich stehe nie im Weg vom einen Spieler hier, wenn du glaubst, dass ich bin gegen euch oder whatever. So ich gehe. Ich gebe dir alles, was ich habe jetzt für dieses Jahr und dann bin ich weg. So don't use me as a fucking excuse. Das ist irgendwie vom Vorstand in meinen Kopf gekommen. And I read between the lines. So this passed me nicht. Das war ein Dunkelpunkt. Das hat mir nicht gepasst. Und die Spieler haben aufgejammert. Holzi ist too tough, he's too hard, he's too tough. Fuck off. Wir waren im Finale letztes Jahr, jetzt sind wir auf der Gutrichtung. Wir haben die Playoffs erreicht. Wir haben Semifinale gewonnen. Eine von der besten Serien seit, ich weiß nicht wie lange, Karl C. Vilak. Es war unglaublich. Wir waren hinter in der Serie. Ich glaube, Pavel hatte ein paar Tore geschossen im vierten Spiel, waren wir hinten 3-1, glaube ich. Das Spiel haben wir in Villa gewonnen, vierte Spiel, best of five.
Game five, final.
The place went bananas in Villa. Das war absolut. Mein Kollege in Tirol war alles für Villa. Villa. Klein für fünfte entscheidende Spiel. 2-1, 9 Minuten vor Schluss. Lancey schießt das Tor.
Ein paar Sekunden später.
Na, nächste Wechsel. Ich habe meine Top-Leute an meinem Stuhl. Der war wirklich defensiv gut. Weil das nächste Wechsel ist für uns wichtig. Wir haben einen Turnover gemacht, was nie passiert. 2-2, Overtime, Super Serie. Okay, Tiefpunkt. Ein paar Leute haben mit der Vorstand geredet. Ich sage, guys, du kannst Holzi jetzt nicht aus sich schmeißen. Fuck, wir müssen wir schon überlegen. Ne? So dann gehe ich rein in den VIP-Raum, war ein Gespräch und ba. Präsident des alles ABCD, alle Leute, the big boys, eh? Rafa mit mir, Seki mit mir, ein paar Leute neben mir, Freunde, having a beer. Well, Greg, I'd like to be dunking for the entire year and to see you later and I'll be the same and bye-bye and the next day. And I go, whoa, this for a teeth punct. This for a slug. Guys with me, they weren't boozy. He's too tepid. So, you have accepted. Well, you have exact as he gave. You have this for the spieler gemacht, wirklich. Das I will nicht im Weg stehen from any from euch. And then hast du einen Grund zum zeigen, warum du nicht gut gespielt hast.
Wir werden das Thema Coaching und das Trainerdasein und deinen reichen Erfahrungsschatz noch sehr, sehr ausführlich bei Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner auch Revue passieren lassen. Eine Frage zum Schluss dieser Konversation habe ich aber doch noch. Weil du natürlich auch aktuell mit sehr vielen Trainern im Austausch stehst und natürlich weißt, was die Trainer moderner Prägung wie ein Matt McIlvain, wie ein Mitch O'Keefe, wie ein Pierre Beaulieu, die mittlerweile alle in ihren 30ern sind und schon Headcoaching-Posten innehaben, machen. Was hat sich von deiner Zeit zur jetzigen Generation am Trainersektor am stärksten verändert? Oder was ist die größte Veränderung?
Well, sicher, wie du trainierst, die old school ist nie mehr so, wie es war, wirklich. We're going to skate you guys till you puke, right? Bis du krank bist. Ich glaube, eine alte Schulmischung mit der Neuschule, the technische Sachen, the bone, the calf, the strike. Aber es wird sich nicht ändern. Ich glaube, was die Trainingmethoden sind schon anders. Die Off-Ice ist viel anders. Die Schläger sind besser. Ich glaube, die gute Trainer, es geht alles um Menschlichkeit der Sachen. It's alles the human factor. Wie du mit Leuten redest, wie du deinen Spieler behandelst. Du musst das als Trainer verkaufen, was deine Ideen sind, mit den Spielern zusammen. Die alte Schule war, it's my way or take the highway, right? Aber ich glaube, dass die Spieler jetzt wollen mehr wissen, warum wir machen sollten. The old days, wir haben alles gemacht, was der Trainer gesagt hat. Oder nicht. So ich glaube, dass ein guter Trainer ist eher, der was wirklich Leidenschaft hat für nicht nur das Spiel, für die Spieler. Und Ehrlichkeit ist absolut top of the list. Du musst ehrlich sein mit deinem Spieler. Aber wenn du lügst und du bist ein bisschen schleimig, ob die Kinder sind 10 Jahre alt, das weiß ich, oder Profis, sie spüren das. Sie spüren das, du bist nicht ehrlich. Ich sage dir Geschichte, wenig Leute wissen das. Peitner weiß es, Raffel vielleicht, nur ein paar Leute, meine Kinder vielleicht drei, vier Leute. Noch, wenn ich in Villach war, wenn die Lockout war, und komischerweise, noch mein zweites Jahr, wenn wir verloren haben gegen Klankwart im Finale, wenn sie haben gesagt, Greg, danke vielmals, goodbye. Der nächste Dezember, ich war in Innsbruck mit meinen Kindern arbeiten, was toll war, und ich habe einen Anruf bekommen. Weißt du von wem? Villach. Der war im letzten Platz. Holt sie. Würdest du die Mannschaft übernehmen und helfen wieder? Here we go again. Und das war das erste Mal, helfen. Überlegen, okay, ja, okay. Geredet, vertragt, hier, ja, boom, wir in der Playoff erreichen. Six Mannschaft fahren, okay, whatever. Dezember bin ich umgegangen. Okay, change a few things, boom, okay, here we go. Ein bisschen besser. Dann war der Lockout, eh? Und dann Eric Weinrich ist gekommen. Ethan Morrow, Captain of the Oilers. Jason Krog. Davis Varedo, im Tor. Praska, im Tor. If I eat a force, okay, but the big boys came in. And I said, oh, this is good. Under the match, I found an outlet to get hold. So the season is gone, we're having the playoff erect. In the last second, the Geschichte is, we said the penalty shoes from Heimo Lender in Graz, and we were all in the cabin, 3,000 Zuschauer in the Villach thing, we're having the playoff erect, but Heimo, Baba. Kurtze had Villach geholfen. So the season geht vorbei. Okay, so. Verloren gegen Wien im Semifinale. He was with Robin Doyle in the bar. A beer. The boys were there. Fear from the boys. I said, Robin, I have to ask you one question. Yeah, Holtz, what's the matter? What do you think? Davy, there was Flagen, wirklich. We had Ethan Morrow, Weinrich, NHL stars, great guys, super guys. Ollie Hiflick, super guys. Greg Duncan, that's to make so good for us. Haben die Burschen, how they like my coaching? Like, ich war neugierig. Wie haben sie gedacht über mich? Like, ich bin kein großer Taktiker, kein großer Baba. And er hat mir gesagt, and this was the Robin Doyle zu mir gesagt hat, in a bar 100 Meter weg from the Eishall in Villach. Aber ich habe ihn gefragt, ich wollte kein Pat on the back, ich war nur interessiert, wie sie gedacht haben. Aber sie reden alle, die Spieler. Ich sage, Holze, this is what sie gesagt haben, the big boys. Vielleicht du bist nicht der beste System guy, aber dein Leidenschaft für das Spiel und für deinen Spieler ist second to none. And jetzt habe ich Goosebumps now, and this is the Wahrheit. Aber wenn ich ein perfektes System habe und ohne Leidenschaft and I don't give a fuck about my players, the system is null. And the system is halbwegs good. We count numbers. You go here. Yeah, it's okay. We'll figure it out. But the Leidenschaft and some, and this is though, on the Glauben on dein Coach vielleicht in a bissel wie es ist, du kannst gewinnen. And nicht mit the perfect system only Leidenschaft and only this Ehrlichkeit in the Luft. On this glaube ich wirklich. And this is an echte Geschichte. Was wenig Leute wissen in my Leben.
Und mit diesem Exclusive und diesen wunderbaren Worten müssen wir dieses Gespräch fast beschließen. Das soll am Schluss stehen. Coach, wir werden noch sehr häufig die Gelegenheit haben, mit dir über Eishockey zu reden. Aber wunderbarere Schlussworte hätte man nicht wünschen können. Vielen lieben Dank, dass du so lange und ausführlich wiederum für Hockey O'Clock Zeit genommen hast.
Martin, my pleasure. Hat mich gefreut.
Das war's also. Folge
4. And that is true. No, because I wanted to know, for me. You know what? I tell you what, I can tell stories about this. Eh? I tell young players in Canada, I tell young players here. We got the Gauthier's and the big boys coming up. Me and Gauthier, it was fucking, I won't even go there. When those guys came, like, you got Busquets and all the girls, good guys. Stu is a great guy. Everybody, okay. You got Eric Weiner coming here. He gets off the plane. And he comes, I'm on the ice, practice is over, but 3-on-3 with the young guys. He knocks on the fucking window. Like, you love these stories, right? Eric Weiner, 18 years NHL, multimillionaire. He flying over here to play for Villach. Hey, Greg, hey, Weiner, how you doing? Craig, Eric, nice to be here. Hey, can I come on with the guys, the kids? Is it the love to the sport or what? He wants to come up play with the, you know, our young guys. We're playing cross-ice 3-on-3. Eric Weinrich. Ethan Moore, these guys. They would walk in the morning. This is true. I tell guys, is there a difference you make the NHL, American League? Is there differences as you move down? Not by everybody, but the general rule, I don't know if that's the right word, your manners and your respect level, it seems to be higher the higher you go up. Guys will walk in the morning in my little office, if you like, and guys will walk by, morning, yeah, morning, morning, yeah, yeah. Oh, good morning, Eric. Morning, Coach, how are you today? Holy fuck. Good morning, Ethan, how are you today? Morning, Coach, how are you? Krog, morning, Coach, how are you? Other import walking, hey, morning, yeah, yeah. I'm not lying. Is there something to the manners? Is there something to the respect level?
Yeah.
Yes, there is, guys.
Yes.
So these guys are the elite of the elite. And they can say, good morning, coach, how are you? Whether they love me or hate me, they're going to say, good morning. Morning, coach.
And this was, as this was still recorded, the bonus track to this episode.
That is recording now?
Yeah.
So. Oh, my God. Now, that's true.
No, it is. It is. Because I was actually just trying to conclude our talk, which I'm now officially doing. Now that we switched into English again, but this is just a perfect ending for a perfect coaching episode. Das war also Coach Holz. Das war Folge 14 von Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner, mit dem Coaches Only. Nächste Woche gibt's natürlich schon wieder einen Coach. Dort wird dann nämlich Roger Bader bei Hockey O'Clock zu Gast sein. Coach, danke nochmal für deine Expertise.
Martin, thank you. Are we off the air now or do I have to be careful what I say here?
Jetzt aber wirklich, das war's.
Jetzt sind wir wirklich fertig.
Das war's mit...
Schade, aber ich habe noch eine super Geschichte. Ciao.
von.
Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner wurde präsentiert von Bet at Home, dem offiziellen Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League. Hol dir jetzt deinen Ice Hockey Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Unsere Liga, dein Spiel.